Let's call the meeting to order. Sorry for the delay. We had, I don't know, bad weather. What should we claim for our delay this morning? Appreciate your patience. This morning we have a number of folks that have come and visited with us on Friday. It was essentially management day. We had Northwest here. So today we've got Labor Day. All of the employees, their representatives, I believe, will be with us today. We're also going to hear from the Metropolitan Airports Commission and the South Metro Airport Action Council. Anybody else that desires to be heard. We also have two bills that will come before us at the end. Before we get underway, anybody that's not familiar with this committee, I hope I have a reputation for being a reasonable, nice fella. Kind of, yeah, do before us to say, well, give or take. But in 17 years of law practice, I learned a long time ago that you get a lot farther trying to be nice to folks and inviting. And that was the approach that I wanted to take with our friends at Delta Airlines. We've sent them a number of polite letters and phone calls and faxes requesting documents and requesting their willingness to come and visit. Many jobs in Minnesota, conceivably thousands of jobs, hang in the balance depending on how this sale goes. As I said the other day, may be the single largest economic event in Minnesota history. When you look at the direct and indirect consequences. So I am, it disappoints me to have to say what I'm about to say, and that is with the folks at Delta, they have all but ignored our requests. I'm beginning to think that Delta stands for don't ever leave the airport, or don't ever leave Atlanta, because that has been my impression of CEO Richard Anderson and the folks at Delta. They have not sent anybody here. They have not provided any response. They have not hired anybody to represent their interests here. We have at all times, and you recall on Friday, and in every letter that I have written to them, every correspondence that we've had with them, have been polite about requests that they come and share their thoughts with us about what this will mean for Minnesota, for Northwest, for the employees, for the traveling public. And they have all but ignored all of those requests. So I was nice before. I'm done being nice. If they want to, we can do it easy or we can do it hard. And they apparently are making a choice to do it hard. I know there's folks here from Northwest. I would hope that our friends at Delta are monitoring what's going on here. But for them to absolutely ignore this state, absolutely ignore the $500 million investment that we have in Northwest, and to ignore this committee's request to even provide someone to provide some answers about the impact on employment, the impact on Minnesota's economy, we're left with the option of considering using subpoenas. Representative Mahoney, you'll recall, pointed that out on Friday. I indicated we don't really need to talk like that. We asked Mr. Hurst to communicate with Delta. We've not heard anything back from Delta, and it's actually beginning now to be a poor reflection on Northwest as well. So Ms. Nelson, Ms. Glumack, I would ask that you share that with Northwest, that they are in concert with the folks at Delta, they are bringing ill will upon the entire transaction and the parties to that transaction. So if we, very simply stated, should we fail to hear anything from Delta by day's end, I will instruct our nonpartisan House staff to begin the process of preparing subpoenas for consideration by this committee. That's not something, you may even hear my voice cracking a little bit, because that is not something I take lightly. That's not something I want to do, and it's not out of anger but out of necessity because of the importance of this event on Minnesota and on Minnesota employees. With that, like I said, we've got a number of good folks here that are joining us today. The first one that I have on the list is Steve Gordon, president of the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. Is Mr. Gordon here? Welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
And Mr. Gordon, if you'd just identify who you are for the record and then proceed with whatever comments you may have, and then I suspect this committee, which is fairly engaged, will probably have a couple questions for you as well.
Well, certainly. My name is Stephen Gordon, S-T-E-P-H-E-N-G-O-R-D-O-N. I am the President, Directing General Chair of Air Transport District 143 for the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers. I appreciate your opening comments. Sentiments are much the same on our side. I'd like to begin by thanking the chair and the members of this committee for the offer extended to the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers to express our concerns about the proposed merger of Delta and Northwest Airlines merger. As I stated, my name is Stephen Gordon. I'm the President, Directing General Chair of IAM District Lodge 143, which represents employees of Northwest Airlines and a number of other airlines. And Northwest Airlines has represented a diverse group of 12,500 hardworking and skilled reservation agents, ticket agents, customer service agents, World Club agents, equipment service employees, fleet service employees, stock clerks, clerical, flight simulator technicians, as well as skycaps. The IAM is by far the largest union at Northwest and the largest in the airline industry. We come before you today because we're firmly convinced, as are many experts in the field, that the merger between Delta and Northwest Airlines is permitted to go forward. It will inevitably result in massive job loss, dislocation, consolidation, and closure, which will have a devastating effect on airline employees, their families, and the communities within Minnesota and throughout the Northwest system. In addition, industry experts predict that a merger will unleash a final round of merger mania. Remaining carriers, much like United, Continental, American, U.S. Airways, Southwest, in reaction, will turn to merge with each other and reduce our country's once proud airline industry down to three major carriers. This will open the door to unrestrained elimination of service and the rise in ticket prices and the further elimination of airline jobs, which are some of the few jobs left today in America that pay a livable wage with health benefits. Amazingly, Northwest and Delta top executives claim that if their merger is approved, they'll simply move the headquarters from Minnesota to Atlanta. They claim no hubs will be closed, no employees will be involuntarily laid off, but nevertheless, the new company will enjoy unprecedented success. They either take the American people for their own employees for fools, or think we suffer from amnesia and don't remember what has happened in recent mergers. We aren't buying their bait-and-switch routine because we've lived through mergers before. It's not long ago that the nightmarish American Airlines and TWA merger was approved, which American Airlines swallowed TWA, virtually eliminated the St. Louis hub and resulted in the termination of a majority of TWA employees, despite Americans' previous assurances to the contrary. The recent merger between U.S. Airways and America West has also resulted in extensive job loss and the downsizing of U.S. Airways' former Pittsburgh hub down to a very small fraction of flights it used to have. If this merger is approved, the combined carrier will begin with 80,000 employees. Delta's Atlanta hub and Northwest Memphis hub are less than 400 miles apart. Delta has a hub in Cincinnati, while Northwest has one 300 miles away in Detroit. Do they really expect us to believe that Memphis and Cincinnati will not be closed, that no service will be eliminated and no employees will be terminated? Yet they will save billions of dollars in efficiencies through this merger. Do they think the fuel prices will be cut in half just because there are half as many airlines? Is it too much to believe that they are going through this massive and extremely costly undertaking simply to maintain the status quo? The reality is that this merger will have dramatic negative impacts on the Twin Cities, our smaller communities, and on the economy of the entire state of Minnesota. Not surprisingly, Northwest executives have downplayed the economic hardships that befall the people of Minnesota and the 12,000-plus men and women of Northwest Airlines. While Delta claims that the jobs to be eliminated, quote, involuntarily, will be on the management and administrative side, which is simply today's fairy tale. Delta CEO Richard Anderson, who you'll recall was Northwest CEO not long ago, has insisted that Northwest headquarters be moved to Atlanta following the merger. Thus, many of the 2,300 employees who work at Northwest headquarters or other Eagan facilities are in jeopardy of losing their employment. In addition, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce predicts that a merger would also likely result in the loss of 500 jobs at the Chisholm Base Reservation Center. You can imagine the impact this will have on a struggling Iron Range economy. Those jobs provide a livable wage and are essential to the economies of Chisholm, Virginia, Hibbing, and other nearby communities. The loss of the jobs in the Twin Cities, Eagan, Chisholm, and everywhere else will seriously hurt those workers and their families who rely on those jobs, not to mention the retail economy and the housing markets in those areas. Those layoffs will have a ripple effect because it's estimated that for every one airline job lost in a community, four other related dependent vendor, service, retail jobs will also be lost. Moreover, Minnesota political and union leaders are well aware of Northwest's dismal track record of making and breaking promises regarding the potential job, job cuts and the impact on the state's revenue picture. Remember when the state bailed out Northwest to the tune of $761 million in 1992, and the airline promised to build an engine maintenance facility in Duluth with a minimum of 500 new jobs? Well, Northwest has had a change of heart, and in 1994, scrubbed plans for the Duluth maintenance facility. However, Northwest still owed the Metropolitan Airport Commission approximately $245 million from the loan, which was supposed to be paid immediately if Northwest relocates its headquarters outside of Minnesota. Where are they going to get the $245 million, which will become immediately payable? I would not be surprised if they tried to stiff Minnesota the way Northwest Airlines under Richard Anderson at that time stiffed their own employees by reneging on an agreement to redeem Series C stock they issued in exchange for wage concessions they had obtained in the early 1990s. They also promised to employ at least 1,000 workers in Duluth, but instead closed their operation there in 2005. Do you remember when Northwest promised to keep keep employment levels in the state at the then current levels of 18,000 employees, which is now down to approximately 12,000? They have left a trail of broken promises throughout this state, and if this merger is approved, there will be many more to come. Just over a year ago, Delta Airlines testified in Washington, D.C., trying to block a takeover by U.S. Airways. Its CEO at the time said that if a merger is approved, quote, it would trigger broad industry consolidation, which would harm consumers in a number of communities, end quote. He testified that a Delta merger would not be in the best public interest. Besides the price of fuel, what has changed today? There's no question that lobbyists, hedge funds, Wall Street, and top executives are approaching Northwest Airlines like sharks in a feeding frenzy. At the thought of multiple millions of dollars in fees, points, stock options, and golden parachutes, while the employees in their communities will be left with the skeletal remains. According to Wall Street Journal, Doug Steelan stands to gain the most by handing Northwest over to Delta. He's only led Northwest since October of 2004, but can bail from Northwest with a very substantial golden parachute package. He'll receive a minimum of $7.8 million if he gives up control to Richard Anderson, the current CEO of Delta. This is on top of the $26 million in stock options he's already received as a result of the Northwest bankruptcy. We don't begrudge Mr. Steele an honest day's wage for an honest day's work, but to sell out your own employees with their hard work and sacrifice made him rich beyond all means is unconscionable. It's also become clear that Northwest has refused to engage in discussions with the IAM or any other employee group, with the exception of the pilots, to address how the employees fit into the merger plan. There's a reason we've been ignored. We are firmly convinced by their conduct that Northwest intends to sacrifice many of its employees to make this merger go with a largely and adamantly non-union Delta Airlines. And will stop at nothing, Delta, with its headquarters in the Deep South, intends to continue to battle unionization and will stop at nothing to maintain their plantation style of management. Finally, I want to make this committee aware of the human toll Northwest tactics have already had on our members that we represent. Through the bankruptcy proceedings, Northwest obtained a court order to force our members to give up 19% of their current wages. This caused many Minnesota families to struggle and pay for basics like mortgage, gas, rent, groceries. Later, by agreement, that was reduced to 11.5% across the board wage reduction, which amounts to $190 million per year from our members in wage concessions to Northwest over 5 years. Our wages have gone down while consumer prices have risen, but by contrast, total executive compensation has gone off the charts.
Yet we were recently told by Northwest Senior Executive Vice President of Labor Relations that unlike the pilots, we were not invited to the table to negotiate about this merger because in the scheme of things, we're insignificant. How dare this company take our $190 million annually to balance their checkbook to save this airline and then say that we're insignificant. Our members have had it, and we're not going to take this lying down. They put many years of sweat equity into this company, have worked harder for less to ensure the survival of this carrier. And this is the thanks we get. We're called insignificant. The American people, and particularly those in Minnesota, have a right to know how much the few stand to gain and how many stand to lose from the elimination of Northwest Airlines through this ill-conceived transaction. We will not go down without a fight, and we'll use every lawful means available to us to save our jobs in this airline in your community. We urge you to stand by us in the struggle. Thank you.
Thank you. And I know Representative Anfield has a question. I just, before we begin, I wanted to welcome Representatives Mason, Morgan, Mador, Wardlow. I believe Representative Paymar is with us this afternoon or this morning as well. And Senator Carlson is here as well. Thank you for joining our committee. I just one quick question just to make sure that I got my arms around the issue, and then I want to go to Representative Anfield. My sense is that you folks are essentially now a partner with Northwest Airlines. You've given of your own money through your concessions, 19%, I believe, 1 year, 11% or 12% another year. What's Northwest or Delta told you about the impact now on your jobs, on your ability to stay organized, on your pensions? What have you heard thus far?
Well, I mean, from the company's position, first about our jobs, they have been pushing their bag of goods to make it sound like there will be a status quo agreement. No one loses their jobs. Everybody will have jobs. I think what needs to be recognized here is a few things. One, with Delta Airlines, they have a wholly owned subsidiary called Tom Air, and they exercise a vendor called DGS, Delta Global Services. So for the company to make the commitment that we'll have jobs, we probably will. However, the question becomes at what rate of pay and what level of benefits. DGS, Delta Global Services, starts at $7 and tops out at approximately $11. I mean, so, and what we've told our people is simply this. JOBS, the acronym stands for Just Over Broke. I'm not looking for a job. I'm looking for a career. That's what this membership has put their money into. Not once, but twice, through concessions. We continue to subsidize a management group that takes complete advantage of the laws of this country to shred, or with the threat of abrogation of contract law if they don't get what they want. They threaten the state continually. Everybody subsidizes this company, and there's nothing that this company is not held responsible or accountable to the membership, the employees, your constituents, and the communities that they serve.
Is it fair to say, Mr. Gordon, that you've received assurance of jobs, but nothing with regard to the substance or the quality of those jobs?
I can tell you that is not a fair assumption. I can tell you exactly this. Northwest Airlines nor Delta has invited us to sit at the table to offer any assurances.
Welcome to the club.
I thought your opening remarks were very appropriate. I thought you were in my shoes. So it's just what they're telling employees is one thing. What they told the collective bargaining agent is another thing.
The point with respect, have you heard anything with regard to your pensions or your ability to remain organized?
We have, the ability to be organized, I mean, if you take Richard Anderson's word, is that he won't break the law, but I can assure you there's they spend millions of dollars to keep unions off this property. And their tactics right now, we're on an organizing campaign in Atlanta and all throughout Delta system to organize the workers. But when you're fighting a budget of approximately $18 to $30 million to keep people off that property, a union off that property, we have no faith in them.
Thank you. Representative Anfield.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for your testimony. I have a comment for the committee, and then a question for the testifier. The comment is, I want to remind committee members that the people of the Iron Range, through the production tax on taconite, which is in lieu of property taxes, gave Northwest Airlines $10 million in corporate welfare to build the reservation center in Chisholm that the testifier alluded to. And to even hint down the road a bit that those jobs and that contract and that commitment that the people of the range made with this company for those jobs, that those jobs would potentially go away, is unconscionable and is a classic example of corporate welfare in corporate welfare when it goes bad. So the committee, I just want the committee to be aware that the public has a $10 million investment in that facility. My question has to do with Georgia, the right-to-work state. Some of us would say it's a right-to-work-for-less state. No union security clause, no organizing rights, no right to fairly work with workers to organize. Do you know of any collective bargaining agreements that are in place by any of the airlines, domestic airlines in the country, in right-to-work states that are holding up and allow workers to bargain collectively with the employer?
Sure. I mean, just under our agreements, we fall into that category. I can't, off the top of my head, speak of which states they are, but yes. I mean, we have union contracts and security provision clauses in right-to-work states.
Okay. That's a good thing.
I wholeheartedly agree with you.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Anfield. Representative Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gordon, you stated in your read testimony that if the deal is permitted to go forward and should not be permitted, my question to you is, what are you asking this committee, you know, as far as our blocking the deal or stopping the deal, what are you asking this committee to do?
Mr. Gordon.
Well, I guess that's a two-part answer for myself. Is one, be very aware of the impact, the potential impact that this could have on your community. I mean, hundreds and thousands of jobs could be lost. And what we're asking for is the opportunity, which was presented today, to express our concerns and hopefully allow you to make an informed decision on whether this is beneficial to the state, to the community. Obviously, the company has come in and testified and pushed what I'd like to call their bag of goods of how prosperous it will be. However, they very rarely mention the downside to what this means. And as I mentioned in my testimony, you don't have to look far. I come from Pennsylvania. I'm from Philadelphia, and I look at Pittsburgh. And take a look at Moon Township, Beaver Township, Aliquippa, and see the impact that this has when commitments are made and not upheld. You know, this is we're just starting. Some people argue that we're just starting to slip into a recession. Throw this in the mix. I come from Detroit right now, and I look around the manufacturing sector in Michigan, and I can tell you on my block of 63 homes, 31 of them are foreclosed on, and I live in a fairly average neighborhood. So what we want you to do, my hope today, is to come in front of you, is to, one, oppose this merger publicly. Take a position publicly and say that's not good for the state, it's not good for our membership, and certainly not good for our community. And I hope everybody listens to what we have to say. We've never reneged on the state. You know, our track record as a machinist union in the state of Minnesota is impeccable, and we'll continue to do so. We're your constituents. The state is nothing more, or this company is nothing more than a business. And if they don't like how they do business, they don't fulfill their obligations.
Representative Zellers, anything else?
Well, no, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess one other question, and Mr. Gordon, you'd mentioned that this was going to start a landslide of mergers, and I just as a matter of fact, the Continental and I think it was Continental and United deal was officially, I think, nixed last week. So just as a matter of fact, on your page 5 of your prepared remarks, I'd just like a little better explanation as to what you meant by maintain their plantation style of management. think there's some kind of inflammatory insinuations there. I want to give you the opportunity to not inflame the situation as we're leaving here today. Maybe not leave a sour or bitter taste in anyone's mouth in the committee.
Well, I certainly respect your opinion. I don't think they're inflammatory. I think they're extremely accurate. Delta rules with an iron fist. If you talk to the union, you'll be terminated. We're down there right now in an organizing drive, and we can't even talk to members in a terminal, in a public terminal, about joining the union because the manager's sitting in a chair reading a paper. So I completely believe and stand true to the comments that I made, not to be offensive, but to give a description of the style of management that they rule with down there. And I have a feeling that if you talk to the employees of Atlanta, they would be willing to testify to the same. We hear the complaints. We hear the issues. Companies can come in here and tell you just the contrary. But we're on an organizing drive in Atlanta, and we know how it works. And we know that these people have instilled fear and intimidation into their employees to talk to the union. And what we can't figure out is why. Every one of them gets a guaranteed contract for executive compensation. So why begrudge us for trying to get a guaranteed contract that takes care of our livable wages, our health care, our pension, our defined benefit plan? You know, is there something wrong with that? I don't think so.
Representative LaForce.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. And Mr. Gordon, I'll mention, of course, you're entitled to your opinion. I just will not join your opinion with respect to the integrity of Northwest Management, et cetera. But I do agree with you on one observation. I don't see how this merger, if it's successful, will go through without closing hubs or losing frontline jobs. I just don't see it. I mean, the reason why business organizations merge is to gain efficiencies, and what that means at a very real level is you're cutting somewhere and you're cutting some things. But my specific question is, has your union, have you looked at the historical record, or have you run any models with consultants to try and get an idea of what you estimate those efficiencies might be, how many jobs might be lost, or which hubs might close? I know you had referenced the geographic proximity, for example, of Detroit and Cincinnati, and I'm just curious as to whether you have done any, your group has done any modeling as to what you think the outcome would be from that perspective if this merger went forward.
No, not at this point, and I will tell you why. We haven't seen the business transaction. So in order for us to assess the loss of jobs, we would actually need some sort of tangible business model presented to us so we can see. However, we haven't been presented with one yet. We haven't even had the opportunity to sit with Delta or Northwest to discuss it at bare minimum.
Representative Force.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I did have a couple of more questions, but I think that's something that the committee ought to be aware of. And again, I am not casting aspersions on Mr. Hurst, and I would have asked him. I handed out this article from the Wall Street Journal, and you notice it was from last Thursday, but like most aspects of my personal life, I'm a couple days behind. But as you can see from the handout here, it is very unlikely, I think, in my opinion, that a merger would go forward and not result in some type of losses, and I think that's important to understand. And, Mr. Chairman, I have a comment and a question, but I appreciate these hearings because, as you've noted, the state offered and Northwest accepted public monies, and I think that certainly increases the oversight responsibilities of the committee. I would think that the legislature would have a stake in this regardless, but the fact that there are public monies involved certainly enhances our responsibility to exercise some oversight. So I'd agree with you there. Mr. Gordon, you know, I can't help but wonder, you know, in my lifetime, and I'm not that old, you know, at Flowen, I can remember being a kid on Braniff and Eastern and Pan Am, and I think there was even a Western Airlines, I recall, from way back when my parents took me out to Disneyland once. It's a volatile industry, and you've highlighted some of your concerns about what might happen as a result of the merger, but it's an open-ended question and one we can't answer right now, but I wonder what would happen if Northwest simply just liquidated and went away. And I guess that begs the question, can they stand alone? I don't know the answer to that, and I suppose I throw it out there as food for thought for the committee, but certainly the primary point I wanted to make is I share your assessment. I don't see how two major corporations merge and do not engage in some kind of cutting to try and find efficiencies. And like I said, what some investors might call efficiencies, I understand your anxiety in calling it job losses. I think they're both very valid points. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Mr. Gordon, any response to that? I don't know that that was necessarily a question or a more of a rhetorical one.
No, I fully respect the comments. I think one of the things that has to be recognized here as we talk about consolidation is the core intent of consolidation is less. It's less service, less jobs, less choice. Otherwise, why consolidate? And to answer the question related to what could Northwest do, could they be a standalone? It's well documented that as the initial conversations of the merger took place and then kind of trailed off a little bit, lost some steam, it's well documented by Doug Steelen that this airline could stand alone. I mean, clearly, I don't want anybody to think that this union doesn't recognize that there are enormous liabilities towards the company at this point in time with the price of fuel. However, how does consolidation recognize or create a viable solution to the price of fuel? You're fueling, instead of 400 airplanes, 900 airplanes. Fuel is not going to go from $120 a barrel to $30 a barrel because Northwest and Delta merge. This is a merger not about fuel. This is a merger about Wall Street, hedge fund investors, groups investors that bought into a company at $25 a share and their stocks at $8. On both sides of the table. That's what this is about.
Mr. Gordon, I don't know much about hedge funds, but I do know about what Representative De La Forest alluded to, and that is actually went home and did the math on what Mr. Hirsch told us on Friday. And he commented quite a bit about the cost of fuel, and he said how much more that was cost him, and then he said, and if you took the figures that he gave and figured in the cost of fuel, there was still a several hundred million dollar gap. It left me with the impression that they either need to increase revenues, and I think you do that in the airline by raising prices, or you have to cut your costs. And my sense is that the only place you can cut costs is with regard to the folks that work for you. So whether that's a quantitative number of jobs that would be cut, or the quality of those jobs, namely through concessions and right. Reductions in the amount of money that you earn. But where else are they going to go? If Northwest has an answer to that, I'd certainly welcome it. But I just did the math. And when the other thing is, speaking of math, I noticed the two CEOs talked about how this will be an addition, not a subtraction. And it seems, so far anyway, all it's led to is division. And hopefully at the end of the day, we will, give me the rim shot with the drum set. The goal of trying to hold these hearings, and if we had full participation from the entity that desires to acquire Northwest, that would help a great deal to allay some of that divisiveness, because they didn't communicate with you, they haven't communicated with us, and they continue to fail to communicate. And that is completely unacceptable for you, for us, and for the taxpayers of Minnesota. And with that, Mr. Gordon, unless there's other questions for you, thank you. We hope you'll stick around. There may be some other things you might want to talk about.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have Renee Foss from the... have you flipped sitting at now Kevin Griffin. Somebody from the flight attendants. Perhaps both. Thank you very much for joining us this morning. I assume there's the fellow that has to write the names down. He wants the card. But welcome to the committee. We assume there'd probably other be places you'd rather be, sunny San Diego or something, than here today talking about this, but we very much appreciate your time. If you could just identify yourself for the record and then proceed with whatever comments you may have, and then I suspect knowing this committee will probably have some questions for you.
Okay, thank you, Chairman Atkins. My name is Renee Foss. It's R-E-N-E-F-O-S-S. And we just want to begin by thanking Chairman Atkins, Representative Lilly, and the committee members here today for allowing us to speak with you. We're very glad to have this opportunity to talk. My name is... Kevin. Sorry.
Thank you, Chairman. My name is Kevin Griffin. I'm with the Association of Flight Attendants, CWA. I'm the president of the National Executive Council for Northwest Airlines.
Welcome to both of you. Who will be leading off for us? Ms. Foss?
Yes. Okay, my name is Renee Foss, and I am a lifelong Minnesota resident. I'm a graduate of Edina High School and the University of Minnesota. I've been a flight attendant with Northwest Airlines for 23 years. I'm also a proud member of the Association of Flight Attendants, AFA-CWA. And today I'd like to tell you a little bit about my past and how it concerns leads to my concerns for my future with Northwest. My mother was a stewardess for Northwest Airlines. She flew from 1951 to 1959. Back then they had a company policy that stewardesses had to quit when they got married. So when my mom married my dad, who was from Lake City, Minnesota, she had to quit the airline. And many people assume that I became a flight attendant because of my mother, and that's not actually true. In fact, I never even really wanted to be a flight attendant or work in the airline industry to begin with. I wanted to be an actress. But my dad didn't think that was a good idea. He thought I should find something a little more practical and encouraged me, or rather kind of ordered me, to get a good job with good benefits at a good local company that would have a pension and job security. And because I'm a good daughter, that is what I did 23 years ago. He told me to forget the show business, and at 22 years old, that was kind of hard to take because benefits and job security didn't mean much to me then. But since then, I've grown up, and I've changed my tune. And today, I cannot tell you how much I value my dad's advice and my job at Northwest Airlines. In the beginning, I thought my job with the airline would sort of be a short-term arrangement, but instead it has become my career and my profession. And up until recently, I felt I did have a good job with good benefits and job security. This now brings me to my concerns for the future, and these concerns are not just my personal concerns, but also that of my sister and brother flight attendants at Northwest Airlines and at Delta Airlines, all the other frontline employees, and the citizens of my home state, Minnesota, and the traveling public at large. I'm not an economist, so I really can't tell you if this merger is a good thing or a bad thing, but I can review the past experiences, and if the past is an indicator of the future, then I would urge all of you to remember and consider some of the past promises from Northwest and ask yourself if they've been upheld. This will sort of echo the previous testifier, but I would like you to please remember the large amounts of money that the state of Minnesota has lent to Northwest Airlines. I'd like you to remember the mechanics, our former mechanics, many of whose jobs have been outsourced. And I'd like to, again, just mention that maintenance base up in Duluth, Minnesota. And now we are hearing more promises. We're hearing promises like no layoffs, no hub closures, no decreases in service, and no outsourcing. And if these promises are broken, it will be too late for me and many of my coworkers and many of the communities in this state, and there won't be any way to go back. And at this time, I would also like to draw your attention to something very important that I'm very concerned about on a personal level. And that is the election for union representation taking place right now with the Delta Airlines flight attendants. Delta Airlines flight attendants are currently a non-union group. Recently, they filed cards with the NMB to have a representational election. And they have every legal right to organize, and we support them in their efforts. Yet Delta executives have launched an extensive anti-union campaign aimed at keeping Delta flight attendants from voting for a union. Senator Edward Kennedy has authored a letter to Mr. Richard Anderson. We have a copy of that letter there if you'd like to look at it. Richard Anderson is Delta's current CEO, and he formerly served in the same position at Northwest Airlines. Senator Kennedy's letter, which has been co-signed by over two dozen other distinguished senators, requests Delta executives to allow this election for the flight attendants to proceed without interference from management. Still, even after this letter has been written and delivered, we are receiving reports daily of flight attendants being harassed and intimidated in the voting process. And this intimidation and harassment must be stopped immediately. Delta has made it clear that they anticipate only one union on the property, and that's ALPA, that's the pilots union. And it seems that their agenda is to eliminate our union, the Association of Flight Attendants, and destroy our contract. And I know that I speak for many flight attendants when I say we would like to have our collective bargaining rights and our jobs protected in any merger. If the Delta flight attendants remain non-union, then our union representation at Northwest will be jeopardized when and if the merger is finalized. Delta management should remain neutral in this election. Ladies and gentlemen, there are many elements to the Northwest Delta merger. And in closing, I would just like to urge you to carefully examine and then re-examine all of these elements. I would ask you to hold the executives legally accountable for what they promise us, so that they cannot destroy our company, our livelihoods, and our state's economy, and then have a good laugh about it 5 years from now at a cocktail party when they walk away with generous multi-million-dollar bonuses. I would also ask that you demand that they stop interfering with the Delta Airlines flight attendants' legal right to organize. And lastly, I would just ask that you honor my dad's hope that his daughter could have a good job with benefits, a pension, and job security. And thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Foss. And I know we've got some questions. I want to make sure that we hear from Mr. Griffin first, if folks can hold off on their questions for a moment. I did want to share one thing with you, which is my acting career. Very briefly, I'm in law school. And I had a friend who was an actor, and he called me up one day, and he said, listen, you've got a personality. Maybe you could go do this ad. I can't do it for you. And he sent me, it was an Armed Forces television ad.
Uh-huh.
It paid, free pizza, a haircut, and $400.
Oh,
which was great because I was hungry, long-haired, and broke.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, boy, this is the greatest way to make a living in the whole world.
Right.
And then I never worked again. I went to a SpaghettiOs deal, and you had to eat cold spaghetti,
right.
And I couldn't do it. So that was the end of my acting career. So this is an endorsement of your father.
Yes.
And always listen to your dad. On a serious note, we hope to do everything we can to try to carry out your dad's hopes.
Thank you very much.
And your family's hopes as well. It's for everybody's benefit.
It really is. It's very important, and particularly with the election and at Delta with our flight attendants there. And Kevin's going to answer the questions and maybe have some comments because I'm not really an elected person. I'm just a flight attendant.
You're an elected person?
He's
you just went down a little bit. But no, I'm Mr. Griffin, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. Thank you for having us, Chairman. I began my career with Northwest back in 1981. So I've been here for 27 years. So I was with two previous carriers before that, so I've seen the deregulation in its infancy and the effects mergers that have taken place, you know, since then. We've seen the airlines I mentioned earlier, Brannus, Pan Am, TWA. Slowly, we've seen what's happened to the industry. And we echo the sentiments of our brothers and sisters of the IAM, you know, and the other labor groups on the property. We totally feel for everyone in this industry, as well as in the state of Minnesota. We've seen the commitments that Northwest has made to labor, as well as to the state, you know. And we're hoping that the state, along with labor, will keep the jobs at Northwest. Right now, we have a problem. We've had a problem for a couple of years with the threat of outsourcing. Northwest, for the past 5 or 6 years, has been trying to outsource our international flights to cheaper labor markets, mainly China, India, Manila, wherever they can. You know, we've continually, as a union, fought off this outsourcing, and as of last week, it's still on the table. You know, with Northwest, you know, for a package they're trying to work out. So it doesn't seem to be going away. You know, people say, well, with the Open Skies Agreement, you know, that's coming up, we'll have European carriers coming in. Okay, well, if we're allowed to outsource, if Northwest is allowed to outsource, we'll be having our positions as flight attendants, 8,000 of us, you know, and possibly 22,000 with the merger, possibly going to other countries such as India and China. So that's one of our concerns. Another concern is, we've asked repeatedly both sides to be at the merger talks, and along with our brothers and sisters at IAM, we've been turned down. We've been given updates as far as the merger, approximately about 5 minutes before they hit the transmit button on the press. You know, so we really haven't been kept in the loop. We've been brought up to speed only because we've been demanding. You know, last summer we ran a campaign called Broken Promises, which was basically Northwest promised to the consumer and to the traveling public, you know, what they hadn't fulfilled, you know. So we're repeatedly working with the traveling public as well as our other brothers and sisters to deliver a product that we believe needs to be maintained, and that's the safe product here in the U.S., you know, with U.S. good jobs. As far as the trust factor at Northwest, you know, we're finding it hard to, you know, believe everything they say. You know, and we've asked for a furlough clause, you know, when they had meetings a couple weeks ago. And they talked about not laying off the frontline employees. Well, some of the definition of frontline employees became a little bit muddied last week. It's like, because who is your frontline employees? You know, I mean, last week it was extended, I believe, to the scheduling department. You know, we find a lot of people who may just jump ship ahead of this merger, you know, because they're not sure over in Building F or Building A, you know, who actually will be here. You know, we're concerned about all our brothers and sisters out there in labor. And once again, as Renee said, you know, we'd like to see Northwest remain neutral. And we were here for the hearings last week when Ben Hurst was asked about remaining neutral. And he gave the same, basically, response and non-response as the two CEOs in Washington did. They're not remaining neutral. You know, we've seen the activities every day, what's going on down there, you know. It's only going to heat up as far as, you know, as time goes by. So we're very concerned about that there. Other than that, that's basically what, you know, I'm here for short questions and answers.
I'll ask the same question just as the initial one. You, like us, are major stakeholders in this company. We've got about $500 million of taxpayer dollars. You folks, I believe, took some serious concessions over the years, financial concessions. I think you sort of alluded to it, but my question to you is, what assurances or what communications have you had from Northwest or Delta about your jobs, about the quality of the jobs, about your pensions, that sort of thing? I assume they've communicated well with you and given you assurances about those.
Well, we have had talks with Barbara Dean, of course, Northwest Labor. We have requested talks with Richard Anderson, but that's fallen on deaf ears out there. We've been given no assurances, you know, that we will actually be here, you know, 5 years from today. We've been given no assurances about, like, a no furlough clause, which we had in the past, you know, which during rough times, you know, we were able to maintain jobs or take leaves of absence or something, you know, to alleviate the problem. So really, we haven't had much as far as written down assurances. You know, we're getting the same lip service that everybody's reading in the press.
Thank you, Mr. Griffin. Representative Ansel.
Thank you again, Mr. Chairman. At some stage in this complicated process, Delta and Northwest are going to produce a merger agreement of sorts. And that merger agreement is going to be the document, I assume, with which the Justice Department determines if this merger is in the public interest. Do you have any reasonable expectation that the bargaining units will have a seat at the table and will be a participant in negotiating union security clauses in the merger agreement or extension of the collective bargaining agreements in the merger agreement? Because it seems to me if that is not negotiated in the development of that agreement, looking at Delta's sorry, terrible anti-union history, and looking at hubs in Tennessee, a right-to-work state, Cincinnati and Detroit, states that have union security clauses, and then throw in Atlanta, I mean, the handwriting's on the wall. So my question is, do you get any indication from any of these folks that there's potential for union clauses in the merger agreement?
And first off, Mr. Griffin, I in fairness to Northwest, late yesterday, they delivered me a copy of the merger agreement as well as a cover letter from Mr. Hurst. I have done my best to read it. It's relatively thick. As far as I could tell, it was silent with regard to protections for the employees. The cover letter from Mr. Hurst indicated that they were unable to, at this time, to make assurances with respect to employment levels, the the whole headquarter hub thing, that that was all yet
okay.
in process, and that they expected to have resolution with respect to some of those issues, I believe you referenced, by the end of 2008. I would have brought that with me to share, but another representative, not me, spilled her coffee on it this morning, so it's actually in the tax committee. I was sitting next to her, and she feels terrible, but it's literally drying in my office. So hopefully once it has dried, I will be able to make a copy for members of the committee. I apologize for not being able to have that available to you sooner. You notice I protected my fellow colleague, but we'll get that to you as soon as we can. And with that, I'm sorry, Mr. Griffin, to have interrupted, but do you have an answer?
Exactly correct. We've been given no assurances. We've actually been told several times they expect a non-union Delta other than Alpha. We do have representation election going on currently. We have in our current contract labor protective provisions, but if we were to lose the contract, eventually we would lose any protections for job security.
Representative Mansell.
Just a follow-up for the committee. I can see a scenario then. The collective bargaining agreements expire. The merged company refuses to bargain with the workers. Workers become morale and all of that goes on. And if you're in a right-to-work state, it's almost impossible to reinvent yourself. And we end up with a bunch of $10-an-hour jobs. And I don't think that's in the public interest.
Thank you, Representative Ansel. So there are other questions. Representative Villick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Voss, we won't, since you're a real person, we won't ask you the tough legislative questions in the committee.
I
was going to say Griffin, I wouldn't want to be you. He's coming for you now. No, Representative Zelig.
And maybe if Chair Atkins had taken some of those acting lessons, his deft at moving his papers out of the way would have been a little bit better.
That's right.
Mr. Griffiths, same question. What legislative or legal action are... I mean, I get the argument or the speech and why you don't like the airline or why you don't like Northwest, but we're supposed to be down here for a bill, and I'm just curious as to what legislative or legal remedies you want this committee to take up and act do to stop the merger. And I'm assuming from your comments that's what you'd like us to do.
That's correct. To be clear, it's not that I don't like Northwest. I wouldn't be here for 7 years if I didn't like Northwest. I do love the job that it's had. I came as a temporary, basically, and 27 years later, I'm still here. There's definitely been a lot of challenges. As far as legislatively, we'd like to see the legislature somehow, create legislation that would protect those jobs here. That would ask the deals of both companies to remain neutral. To somehow ask the NMB to assist with this representational election and just let it be fair and equal. That's all we're asking, is to continue having a voice for the workers and for the community.
Thank you. Any other questions for Mr. Griffin or Ms. Lutz? Representative Willie.
Mr. Chair and members, we had at our last hearing, I talked quite a bit, and I'm probably not going to talk as much, but there's a couple things that have come up, and I usually don't try to argue with other members, but there's been a couple things that have been mentioned by folks up here, and one of the things that you said is, or that was mentioned, is about the plantation style. And I'm just going to tell a quick story. Last year at Northwest Airlines, I worked for Northwest Airlines, and there was an incredible storm at the airport. The wind was flying, and I didn't know it, but the ramp had been shut down from the wind. And I'm driving one of these tugs. You've probably seen them. They're out there on the ramp. Well, this piece of equipment that one of the maintenance guys that they use, or a big piece of equipment that's as tall as the ceiling, well, it was, you could see it, it was moving, being pushed by the wind, the brakes had busted loose. Well, it's moving across the runway, so I see it, and I didn't really think about it, but it was going right towards an airplane. So I drove my tug, and I drive into it and basically block it, because it would have hit an airplane, you know. So my thumb's sore every day. So I go into the manager, well, that's later, still sore, but at the time it's sore, you need to report the incident. So I go in there and I have a, you know, you go to the chief and chief says, well, go see the manager, so you need to fill out documents. Well, the manager says, you know, you need to fill out this form, so I fill it out. Well, they didn't fill it out at that time because we were pretty busy with the weather. You know, the airport was kind of melting down. So what happens is he sends me this form a couple days later saying, basically, it's my fault. The ramp was closed. I should have been inside, which I didn't know. You know, I was out there in good faith. And he basically gave me, if you will, discipline for, you know, ill performance of my job when, you know, I mean, it's a airplane that's backed up, ready to fly when the weather breaks. And, you know, I don't know, but I think I might have saved the airline a lot of money, certainly time, inconvenience. But still to this day, my thumb's sore. I mean, these things happen repeatedly. To say to these people, well, that's the plantation, I know those are strong words, and I get that, and I knew where you're trying to go, but it's just, it's an amazing place, you know, where everybody's kind of covering themselves, and I know the attorneys are, you know, you know, it's a tough world that way. You know, they have a sign off, and anyways, so that's, I'm a little uncomfortable with I'm uncomfortable with the word usage, but it's you know, it's a strange situation. I was glad to hear the testifier, Ms. Voss, where you said that these people, that you value your job, that you consider it a career, a profession.
I do.
And that's the same thing with, you know, my workers, the 5,600 people in Minnesota that are ramp workers as well. I mean, you wouldn't think of it that way, but these are simple people. They care, and kind of like I said last week, they put up stickers on their car. In my office, I've got an airplane. You know, I mean, people are proud of the business. I mean, and care. So some of that is, you know, it's hard. And the reason I'm guessing, and your group and our group, we gave concessions, is because we cared about this company, this Minnesota company. That they were going to be there, like a 3M. And we all know the world's changing, but, you know, it's just hard when you give a concessions, and then you know that these folks at the top are probably going to get, you know, these golden parachutes or do really well. It's just, I mean, it just isn't fair. And then, and it's not right. It's not a Minnesota value, and it's frustrating. And I, you know, just with the pledges, and we're kind of going, why we're here, is a pledge to Minnesota, and I'm okay with corporate subsidies to some degree. I, you know, but the relationship has to be a two-way thing. It's got to be the state gives something, and there's something to be expected, that they're going to give back, that they're going to give decent jobs to Minnesota, not these $7, $9, $11. I mean, people, I mean, you've got to have some reasonable expectation. For me, it's just one example, but, you know, my sore thumb for the rest of my life, you know, it's not the end of the world, granted. I didn't lose a leg or something, but it's, you know, I mean, these people lift things, they have, you know, it sounds odd, but, I mean, a lot of them get hurt from suitcases falling down on them, and, I mean, it's they're working. So you want a Minnesota, I think, as the commerce and labor, I think, you commit to companies in the state of Minnesota to make it so our businesses are successful and keep them here. But the flip is that you kind of expect that they're going to pay their employees a reasonable rate, you know, for the service that's rendered. So, thank you. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Representative Lilly. Are there other questions, or Representative Wardlow?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for allowing us to join your committee.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you for joining.
Representative Lilly, I knew there was a hero inside of you someplace. I just could tell it just talking to you. But are you still proud to be a member of the employee of Northwest Airlines? I just want to...
Mr. Karen, Representative Wardell, you know, I don't know what it is. I love the airline. You know, it's a weird business. There's a lot of people out there that really care. I mean, I kid you not, you walk by, and maybe I'm just an odd duck, but you reach up and you run your hand alongside the airplane when you walk by it, and you wave to the customers. I mean, these people care. Even on the ramps, I know they do upstairs, the pilots, you know, it's not about money. I mean, yes, you want to make a living, but people care. Yes, yes, I am. Yes, sir.
Representative Wardell.
Same. My point in that question was, here's a man who has been treated poorly, and yet he's still proud to be of service to that airline. I'm just making an observation, because I know it's when you have a leader in front of you who you're not being treated well by, it's hard to be loyal and it's hard to be proud to be working with that person, and yet you were... It's an amazing story that you would be treated that way, but yet you're still proud of the airline. I guess that's a testimony to the workers, because you're not the only one, obviously.
Thank you, Representative Wardell.
And I don't know why I brought that up, but it was just an observation.
You're a kind, big-hearted fellow. Are there other comments or questions? Representative Tilbury and then Representative Medor.
Yeah, I just have one comment. I asked the question last week of Ben Hurst. I asked him if what kind of guarantee there was because he had made the comment that he would keep the frontline jobs and employees, and he just made a comment quickly of, well, they won't lose their job. And I used the term of hold harmless. I guess I need help from the committee, because I think I heard a lot of words, but I'm not sure I heard what the concept was, and maybe Chair Atkins, you could tell me if you saw anything in that report that you just received. I know you mentioned something, but could I hear that again?
Representative Tilbury, please understand that I read it briefly. It's a thick document relative to the merger of the two airlines, but it in the cover letter indicated that the agreement is silent on job protection and the sort of be it seniority and pensions and all of that sort of thing. Although, in fairness to Mr. Hurst, in the cover letter, he acknowledged that they're unable to provide those answers at this time, that it's an ongoing process they anticipate completing by the end of 2008, but that they intend to share that sort of information with us. Representative Tilbury, otherwise I've got to that point. Representative Anselt or Representative Tilbury, I want to make sure that
just real quick,
Representative Anselt.
In reaction to your question, which is a heck of a good one, in absence of a clause in the merger agreement, keep in mind this isn't just a merger that's being proposed. It's a merger and a relocation in a right-to-work state. And I think that tells us, that should tell us a lot about where this new company wants to go. Especially when you look at Delta's history. And that's what concerns me the most.
Thank you, Representative Anselt. Representative Tilbury, are you still in force?
Yeah, the only thing I want to add to that is I do want to have some kind of an idea from these two companies how it is going to affect. And I guess the sooner the better would be nice. Because I think we do have an investment there that we are looking at, and we have talked about it, and we have our testifiers here talking about it, and... I just feel we need to know some facts as soon as possible.
Thank you, Representative Tilbury. I think we'll hear from Representative Medor, and then we've got the South Metro Airport Action Council and the Metropolitan Airports Commission. That'll conclude our testimony, then we'll take up some bills just to sort of lay out the roadmap. Representative Medor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And for the testifiers, I'm wondering if you can just give me an idea, in particular with the flight attendants. I actually have a lot of friends who are flight attendants, and I've seen over the years the concessions that you've had to take over and over and over again. They went from working decent shifts with appropriate layovers to these short flights, and then that cut into their hours. It was a real mess, but you've all stuck in there, and I have to give you a lot of credit for that. Can you tell me what is the differences, the way that your union is operating with Northwest versus Delta, and do you have any idea about those flight schedules and things like that, and what kind of an impact it is, and also if there's any salary comparisons that you can make for me, if you can.
Right. Well, right now, I mean, Delta has a policy manual as far as work rules and pay, you know, and it's subject to change on the hour, by the day, by the month. Okay, they don't have a contract. And what they've been doing recently is they've been throwing pieces of the pie at them. $1 an hour more internationally recently. They've increased their sick time, you know. But on average, their cost is lower, which means with benefits and work rules, you know, it's cheaper to have the Delta flight. Even though it looks like they're making more in pay, they're losing someplace else. As far as our concessions, I mean, the total package, we've lost 40% last round, and that includes benefits and pay. So most people are working.
Well, we have to work 20% more.
Plus.
We have to work 20% more, and we're earning 40% less because they've increased the amount of from the minimum line, what we call the minimum work. So in essence, we're working. Some flight attendants are, you know, flying 100 hours a month, and when I say 100 hours a month, I really want to clear this because people don't always understand our schedule. We're paid basically when the engines are running. So if we're on a layover or if there's a delay and we're sitting parked at the gate or we're somewhere on our layover, we're not accruing that 100 hours. We are only accruing that really when the engines are running. So that doesn't maybe sound like a lot to people who work 60 hours a week, but for us to work 100 hours a month is, you know, a lot of time. I mean, it's probably 20 days away from home. And we took these big pay cuts, and it's a lot of the work rules have changed. Some of the places that we stay in, the different hotels, and the different things that we're doing on board the aircraft have changed. And it's our whole profession is changing, you know, and particularly after 9/11, with the safety and security of the traveling public, we have a great responsibility if something happens on board an aircraft. So, I don't want to take away from your answer, but what your friends are telling you is true.
And Ms. Buzz, that was addition, not subtraction.
Okay.
Thank you both very much for your comments, and if you can, I don't know what your schedule is, but we've got a couple of bills up later that there may be questions or comments you may have with respect to that as well. Thank you both.
Thank you very much.
Next is Mr. Spensley, Jim Spensley from the South Central Airport Action Council. Spensley, welcome to the committee, and if you could just identify yourself for the record and proceed with your comments, and then there may be a question or two.
Thank you very much. My name's Jim Spensley. I live in South Minneapolis near the airport, and I'm president of the South Metro Airport Action Council, which is a not-for-profit citizens advocacy group representing about 400 Duquesne families who are around the airport and a couple of businesses and related organizations. The legislature should be congratulated for taking up questions about the merger of Delta and Northwest. And I'm here representing ordinary citizens in the deal. I'm thankful, Mr. Chairman, that you postponed my remarks until after I had heard a couple of the questions from the committee, because I believe I'm going to be able to add some facts and some information and some viewpoints that the committee may not have considered. Both Delta and Northwest, as you know, operate several busy hubs. Hub airlines' gate dominance effectively prevents its competitors from serving connecting passengers. And the government allows, as you may know, airlines to refuse out-of-town reservations. At issue here is how the newly expanded saw that MSC might be used after the merger. Without either regulatory requirements or commitment, the Delta, as stated, and industry analysts have remarked, that hubs will be consolidated after the merger, with probably Memphis and Cincinnati operations steeply decreased. Minnesota needs to be interested in how and when changes will be made here at MSP. If the MSP, and I'm going to outline three sort of scenarios and what we see as the consequences of those. So if you bear with me, I'm not talking about the same thing all the time, but I'm talking about a premise. And the first premise is the MSC hub is moved to Detroit or elsewhere. If it is, almost certainly there will be a decade or more of financial crisis at MSC. Airline service sufficient for Minnesota economic needs is threatened just by uncertainty as to the new Delta plans and schedules for this airport. No doubt the Airports Commission is going to testify that MSP costs per in-plane passenger are lower than at many airports, and demand will persist, and this could attract other airlines to increase operations here. However, because of debt and overexpansion of gates at MSP, this ratio is misleading. If MSP employments are reduced, the capital costs and debt service will still remain, and overbuilt MSP terminal facilities will be more available but less used. Unless debt repayment is extended or airline operations are further subsidized, other airlines would not realize a comparatively better cost per passenger at MSP. So if other airlines came here, it would be because local business demand persists, high fuel and other costs are universal. In that event, we still pay the cost in higher airfares. On the other hand, big oil profits might completely stifle demand. Fares get too high. Obtaining additional airline service with so much debt outstanding from expansion would then be very difficult here. MSP revenues could decline precipitously. Northwest is the dominant airline at MSP, made various representations to and through the Minnesota the Metropolitan Airports Commission and to the legislature about supporting jobs, public benefit programs to reduce airport noise and control air and water pollution, and other commitments. But this support is primarily, in the case of noise and pollution, is primarily after the fact mitigation, which is subject to withdrawal and reduced financing depending on details of merger, particularly in this scenario where operations are greatly reduced. We believe under this scenario that neighborhoods near MSP wouldn't get noise and pollution relief. The program's funds depend on airline landing fees and gate lease revenues, as well as some passenger fees, and they could be lost or indefinitely delayed in a merger. Various representations made by Northwest to secure gate leases and landing rights at MSP are again in doubt. They, in fact, under this scenario, they get out of their leases. And delay, at least, includes some court-ordered schedules in the lawsuits that you may be familiar with. We believe the legislature should not allow MAC to terminate more than a few of their gate leases without substantial prepayment against lease commitments, and that the payment should be at the original rates, which included amortization of capital costs. In the event MAC intended to allow contracts to be terminated in the merger, the state must hold that MAC lacked the real authority to make contracts favoring a corporation against public interest. The merged airline rightfully should either honor the leases, Northwest lease terms and tenure, or fully compensate MAC in the state of Minnesota for the cost of building the to be unused facilities. neither ball clubs nor airlines ought to profit from public facilities and leave taxpayers holding the bag for, in this case, billions of dollars in bond debt. Another scenario is the MSP, after the merger, the MSP hub is kept pretty much intact. But there's major problems with that as well. By expanding MSP, the state plan to retain airline jobs in Minnesota, not necessarily Northwest jobs, airline jobs, to increase airline competition, to provide lower fares and better service for Minnesota travelers, and to maintain aviation safety and security. It hasn't happened. Expanding Northwest Hub is not the same as expanding the airport. The state of Minnesota, through MAC, is culpable. The dual-track process addressed sustainable growth and economic impacts of aviation here objectively, but as implemented, MSP expansion favored a larger hub, mainly benefiting Northwest Airlines, and financed it based on false assurances by Northwest Airlines management. MAC, in fact, built Northwest more gates immediately after 9/11. If Delta Northwest schedules, especially hub flights, are maintained, fares and fees will remain very high for Minnesota businesses and travelers. And the upshot is that a few less flights per day at a hub don't necessarily reduce the peak hour rate or increase safety. Busy, congested hubs complicate operational safety and security. We can expect steeply increased public costs for safety and security during operational peaks, particularly on a per-passenger basis if the hub is not reduced. Consider the effect of a crash or a terrorist incident and how that might affect flight demand. Probably the best but most unlikely alternative is more balanced use of MSP. By a 40% reduction in the hub, not abandonment or continuation, Northwest Delta, or Northwest, if the merger doesn't go through, could reduce their costs significantly by leasing fewer gates, balancing their staff, and decreasing flight delays. Peak hour rates of only 100 to 110 operations per hour would be substantially safer than the planned 150 to 160. And if 20 or 30 of the peak hour slots were used by competing airlines and gates, the hub could operate from as few as 45 or 50 gates instead of the 90 that they use now. MSC could still have about the same number of daily flights overall, but there would be an opportunity for low-cost service. This plan is more likely to result in lower local fares and a shallower dip in airport revenues, and there may be no other way to attract competing airlines. So this is the alternative that you should be working for. Minnesota will suffer more than most states from airline mergers. And I lost my place here, excuse me. And if Delta and Northwest are able to continue operating for a while after the merger, we still have things at risk. The state should actively oppose the merger as anti-competitive and inappropriate because of the public financing. And that's the best circumstances. It could be disastrous at worst.
Mr. Spencer, yeah. I might. Are you relatively close to the?
I am. I have one more paragraph.
That's what it sounded like it, but I just wanted to, because I've got to make sure that we hear both of the bills yet this afternoon.
A return to fair pricing rules and better enforcement of existing trade regulations, including enforcing predatory temporary laws against predatory temporary fare reduction, would be better market economics for us. High fuel costs make the hub and spoke system itself uneconomical because connecting flights add distance and expensive stopovers compared to direct point-to-point flights. The advantages that the hub and spoke system used to offer in consolidating demand through collector or spoke flights have mostly faded. The cost per passenger mile is higher than ever, and population growth in many cities has made consolidation unnecessary or less cost-effective for the traveler. So the tendency to fewer, more consolidated airlines is not in the public interest, period. Thank you. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to try to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Spensley. I think you provided a very good overview of the situation. Are there questions or concerns? Are you able to remain?
I am.
Okay, because we may have additional questions once the bills come up. Unless there's other questions? Mr. Spensley, thank you very much. We appreciate your time. Also appreciate your patience. I think we had you listed as number one on the list of testifiers. So.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was pleased to be able to offer a little bit about how the differences in the major hub airlines operations and still larger airlines and the situation before, primarily through federal government subsidies and state support to the entrenched airlines, changed the pattern in such a way that the cost of fuel is felt more by the hub and spoke airlines because of all the indirect flights they have to do. And, you know, to get you from point A to point B costs more if you fly indirectly.
No, that's the point I hadn't thought. Thank you.
Thanks.
As our friends from the Metropolitan Airports Commission are joining us, Representative Mullery moves to the minutes of the April 25th meeting. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none, that motion carries. Gentlemen, welcome to the committee. If you'll just, you've done this before, so just identify for the record who you are and then proceed with your comments. We'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jeff Hamill. I'm the Executive Director of the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and with me today is Tom Anderson, the Commission's General Counsel. If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to start by simply talking a bit about the industry that we've been living in for the last 3 decades. I have been an employee of the Metropolitan Airports Commission for more than 31 years. Tom Anderson has either been a direct employee or a consultant, legal consultant to the Commission for 34 years. I tell you this because if you go back to the situation we find ourselves in today, it started, I believe, in 1998 when the U.S. Congress passed the Airline Deregulation Act of 1978. Since that time, we have seen a volatile roller coaster of an industry that has suffered significant changes and challenges over time. And let me just take you through a very brief history because I don't want to belabor because time is short. However, following 1978 Deregulation Act, it was a couple of years later when the PATCO strike took place and virtually all non-management air traffic controllers in the United States were terminated and replaced by other employees. In 1986, Northwest Airlines purchased Republic Airlines. That was in October of that year. 3 years later, there was a leveraged buyout of Northwest Airlines by Mr. Al Checky and Gary Wilson, which led to the arrangements that currently exist with Northwest Airlines. In 1990-1991, those were the years that Northwest Airlines and MAC negotiated the package along with the state of Minnesota that led to the overall state financing package we've been talking about today. In 1993, Northwest Airlines once again was faced with a potential bankruptcy and required not only significant concessions from employees, but also found itself dealing with a loan package from the Metropolitan Airports Commission. In 1998, there was a significant pilot strike which shut down the airline for almost 2 weeks. In 2001, 9/11, a catastrophic event in aviation history took place with the aircraft hijackings and crashes in New York and Washington, literally shutting down the airline industry for 6 days and shutting down general aviation for nearly 6 months. In September of 2005, Northwest Airlines ultimately did file bankruptcy. In October of 2005, Mesaba Airlines, one of its partners, also filed bankruptcy. In May of 2007, Northwest emerges from bankruptcy. In August of 2007, Northwest invests in Midwest Airlines, and the whole dialogue continues. The bottom line is that what I've done is sticking on a very, very brief, very cursory review of what's happened in this industry in the last 30 years since deregulation. Since 1978, names like Braniff, Eastern, Hughes Air West, National, North Central, Ozark, TSA, Pan Am, Piedmont, Southern, Texas International, TWA and Western Airlines have disappeared. Several airlines have attempted to start up and be competitive. You'll remember people have expressed ValueJet, Morris Air, Air Florida, Reno Air, and the list goes on and on and on. Today we have surviving low-cost carriers that still challenge the legacy carriers. JetBlue, Southwest Airlines, AirTran, America West. ATA was on my list, but I just scratched that one today, realizing they filed bankruptcy about a week ago. And, of course, in our local community, Sun Country Airlines has evolved from primarily a seasonal charter carrier to a scheduled airline and seasonal destination carrier of choice. The bottom line is that when we talk about volatility in this industry, and we talk about what's happened since deregulation in 1978, we've seen 160 airline companies file bankruptcy and disappear. And since 2000, more than 20 airline companies have disappeared through bankruptcy processes. At the same time, we in the airport side of the equation have found ourselves looking at dynamic change as well, because what happens to the airline industry reflects upon the airports themselves. And what we have seen in Minneapolis-St. Paul is our airport become a hub airport, and a fortress hub for that matter, primarily because we were the site and the location of Northwest Airlines. When Northwest and Republic merged in 1986, that left Minneapolis-St. Paul as a fortress hub in that one carrier consisted of about 75-80% of our total operations, meaning that there was one clear, highly competitive, dominant carrier. And Minneapolis-St. Paul proved to be a very successful hub along with Detroit and Memphis as part of the new Northwest Airlines system. Bottom line is, when we talk about volatility in this industry and we talk about changes and shifting, I guess I'm here to tell you that at least several of us on the staff of the Airports Commission have ridden this roller coaster all the way through for the last 30 years. We've negotiated numerous contracts and agreements with the airlines, not just Northwest Airlines. We've watched airline companies come and go, and we've watched airlines make changes and adjustments to reflect the economics and the climate of the business within this industry. It has not been an enjoyable experience for employees of the airlines. It has not been an enjoyable experience for traveling public to find themselves faced with additional challenges of security screening, longer lines at airports, and reduced service. For the airport, however, our life has been probably the most stable element within the air transportation industry, from the standpoint that airports, as pieces of real estate, are simply landlords that accommodate airline operations. So our life has been more stable and more predictable than our fellow employees in the aviation industry elsewhere. Let me take you to 1992 for a few minutes, because we've been talking about the loan. This is the GO-15 loan that was made by the Airports Commission in the 1991-92 time frame. Basically, together with the state of Minnesota, we worked out a financial arrangement with Northwest Airlines that basically provided the carrier to be able to continue to maintain operations and be financially viable. This was at a time when Northwest Airlines was seriously looking at bankruptcy filing. And it was the contribution of their own airline employees, coupled with Metro Airports Commission's loan, that led to the airline pushing through this challenging time. At that time, we issued a $270 million general obligation bond and also provided $45 million in additional financial incentive to the airline company, which, by the way, that $45 million in cash has been completely repaid. Those bonds that were issued for $270 million were refinanced in 2002 to take advantage of much more favorable interest rates. And as a result, the airline received benefit from that. However, the important point on this is regarding the $270 million loan, since that loan was made in 1991-1992, Northwest has never missed a quarterly payment on its obligation. You should also be aware of the fact that the first 10 years of payment was interest only, and then following this, from the 11th year to the present time and until they're fully paid, it's a combination of interest and principal. The airline has, in fact, met all of its obligations with the Metropolitan Airports Commission regarding the repayment of those loans. The airline has not asked for any forgiveness or any relief from paying back those loans as a result of this merger, at least at this point in time, and with the Airports Commission fully expect Northwest Airlines to fully repay its bond obligations to the Metropolitan Airports Commission and to the citizens of Minnesota. As part of the 1992 financing, the airline agreed to maintain hubs at Minneapolis-St. Paul and headquarters in the state of Minnesota. To date, the airline has remained in compliance with those covenants. Northwest Airlines also make commitments to maintain minimum levels of employment in Duluth, Hibbing, and statewide. However, the Hibbing and Duluth commitments were renegotiated in 1994, and since 2004, Northwest has relied on a force majeure provision in the original agreements to justify lower employment levels, which can be discussed a bit later. Minnesota's actions on the airline's behalf in 1992 resulted in tremendous growth in air service from Minneapolis-St. Paul and the folks who travel through our airport. And I want this to be factual. I don't want you to take my comments as being supportive of one side or the other. They're simply the facts of what's happened since that loan took place. Instead of having the airline go into bankruptcy and significantly alter its future growth and so forth, we believe that the loan did the following. Northwest Airlines carried more than 23 million passengers through Minneapolis St. Paul in 2007, compared to 16 million in 1992. When you add service flown on Northwest Airlines regional partners, that number jumped to 27 million passengers in 2007 and 16.5 million people in 1992. Bottom line here is that we've seen substantial passenger activity and growth through the Minneapolis St. Paul hub. From MSP, travelers could obtain jet service to 21 international markets in 2007, compared to only 8 14 years ago. 14 years ago, there was no service to Asia from Minneapolis-St. Paul. Today, carriers regularly fly from Minneapolis-St. Paul transcontinental to Tokyo, London, Amsterdam, Reykjavik, Iceland, and, of course, last April the 8th, started new service to Paris, France. MSP currently has 127 aircraft gates, up from 74 in 1992. Northwest leases 101 of those gates, up 54 from that time period. I go through this recollection with you because the question is frequently asked, if you had the choice to do the 1992 loan again, would you do it? And my answer is that for the $270 million in financing we provided at that time in bond issue, plus the $45 million in cash, with a remaining outstanding debt of $245 million in consistent payments, the reality is that our airport and our community have benefited significantly from the infusion of money that helped this country push through a potential bankruptcy scenario. What about 2007? To briefly summarize where we are as a result of the following, the most recent negotiations in 2007, let me simply say that MAC has taken an active role in monitoring ongoing developments and has proactively negotiated agreements to protect the interests of the traveling public and the citizens of Minnesota. We have guaranteed competitive access to competing airline companies in Minneapolis-St. Paul and provide no emergency opportunity to compete in this marketplace against all of the carriers. We've had to lower airline costs of operation, and we provided MAC a future as far as financial security goes. I might make a point that Mr. Spencer just commented that he felt that the MSP was in some jeopardy from the standpoint that as the airlines continue to reduce service levels and fewer people fly to the Minneapolis-St. Paul hub, that could, in fact, jeopardize the financial viability of our airport authority and the investments and improvements that we made at this airport during the last 10 years. In reality, our financial modeling that we have done protects the MAC because we've calculated much of our financial need based on origination and destination passengers only. Those are people who want to come or arrive and depart from the Minneapolis-St. Paul market. Does not include the financial benefit brought to us by connecting passengers. That's an individual leaving from New York, passing through Minneapolis-St. Paul, en route to, say, for example, Seattle. We can handle our financial obligations and have demonstrated this in our various bonding documents last year to show the financial community that, in fact, MSP is well-secured and financially viable under almost any scenario that takes place. Certainly, more traffic, more activity, more passengers means more money. More money means paying our bills and our obligations more easily. But in fact, if there was a hunkering down of our operation, and in fact, reduction in our size, the reality is that we can meet our financial obligations and pay the remaining $1.9 billion in outstanding debt as a result of our construction improvement on the airport. MAC and the state of Minnesota have binding commitments from Northwest Airlines side of the 1991 state financing package regarding the maintenance of a hub, a headquarters, and a Minnesota employment levels. Rent reductions provided to Northwest as part of the 2007 bankruptcy reorganization are tied to ongoing maintenance of its Minneapolis hub and headquarters. That is clearly stated. Tom Anderson will talk about that in a few minutes as far as how clearly that is stated and what the obligations actually are. Bottom line, MAC is positioned to review its options legally available to it and act to protect air service and jobs in Minnesota. If existing commitments will not be met, those options could include required repayment of approximately $245 million in outstanding bond obligations and loss of rent reductions and revenue sharing valued at between $11 and $18 million a year through the year 2020. All throughout my career with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, our goal has been to try to grow air service. Our negotiation in 1991 and 92 and financing the loan package was to assure scheduled airline service of high quality in the Minneapolis-St. Paul market, to maintain a hub, to maintain a headquarters, and to protect jobs in the state of Minnesota. The Commission remains in that position today. And with those remarks as an introduction, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn to Tom Anderson and let him discuss with you a couple of the key points regarding the details of the transaction.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Tom Anderson, General Counsel of the Metropolitan Airports Commission.
I plan to identify the specific covenants that you've been hearing about and been discussed in these hearings, and then talk about the remedies that are available under the legal documents that we have in the event that those covenants are breached, so that there's a full understanding of the options that are available, of the rights that the Airports Commission and the state has if these agreements are not met. As you know, there are commitments in both what we've termed the GO15 covenants that are contained in the state financing package that was originally done in 1991, and then commitments contained in leases that MAC entered into with Northwest Airlines in 2007. The GO15 obligations, as we refer to them, involve various sets of public policy covenants to maintain employment levels in the state, to maintain a hub, and to maintain a headquarters. And in our written material, I've given you copies of the of what those covenants are with respect to specific employment levels. I neglected, unfortunately, to provide the specific commitments regarding Duluth and Chisholm employment covenants. Those are also contained in the 1991 agreement. We can supply those later. And the definitions of the corporate headquarters and hub. The hub is defined as providing a certain minimum level of flights and a certain percentage of connecting passengers. And by these 1991 covenants, Northwest has agreed to maintain those levels. The corporate headquarters is defined as the principal office of the corporation, where its business is conducted, and the principal office of its chief executive officer. The reality, however, in the 1991 covenants is that their exclusive remedy for failure to comply with those covenants is early repayment of the loan that was provided to Northwest. And it's a fairly complicated structure that was negotiated in 1991 with the competing interests throughout the state being involved to make sure that that this development would take place. And it ended up being fairly complicated. The headquarters covenant is very straightforward. If they don't maintain their headquarters, the outstanding amount of the loan has to be repaid over a very short period of time. Given the current remaining amount of the loan, that would be over a period of 1 year, essentially. So, what that means, translated into numbers, is that the $245 million outstanding balance would have to be repaid not over 12 years, which is the remaining term of the loan, but over a year. Now, it's a little more complicated than that because there are obligations to bondholders. In other words, Northwest pays rent to the airport. That goes into a trust account, and then that money is on a biannual basis paid to the bondholders. We have a reserve of what they pay us in advance. And so the effect is that the bondholders have the right to have those bonds outstanding until 2012. There's a 2012 call date, that was called. So we can't simply take the money from Northwest and pay off the bondholders. The bondholders have the right to the interest, at least through the 2012 date. So it's a little more complicated than saying it's pay us the $245 over a year, because there's a call premium and there's interest that has to be calculated in. But roughly speaking, there is a substantial penalty in the money that they would have to otherwise pay us through 2020. Now would have to be paid in just 1 year, roughly $245 million, actually slightly less than that. The remedies for breach, that's the headquarters. The remedies for breach of the hub and employment covenants is far more complicated.
Mr. Anderson, can we interrupt you for just a moment, Representative Willis?
Mr. Chair, I was just wondering if we could have Mr. Anderson define what headquarters is and would mean.
The definition, Mr. Chair, is contained in the attachment of Exhibit 1. It's defined as the principal office of the corporation from which its business is conducted and the principal office of its chief executive officer.
Representative Lilly, is that satisfactory for now?
Yes, sir.
All right. Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With respect to breaching the hub and employment covenants, there's a fairly complicated formula regarding prepayment that says money has to be paid early only
to the extent only and only to the proportion in which they are the airline would be in breach of that covenant. So if there's a required employment level of 16,000 and they're at 12,000, roughly that percentage, slightly more, but roughly that percentage has to be repaid. Only if you get to a 50% reduction in employment would the entire amount have to be prepaid. And the prepayment period also is fairly complicated. It isn't just simply you have to pay it in a year. That period of time for prepayment could stretch out to as long as 9 years, depending on whether there are a number of breaches or just a single breach. So I certainly don't want to go through all the specifics unless you wish, but the point here is that breach of the employment and the hub covenant under the GO-15 documents does not simply require immediate prepayment of the loan, whereas as to the headquarters, it does. Northwest reports annually on its compliance with these covenants, except when they were in bankruptcy. Then they were not required to report by the bankruptcy law, so the bankruptcy law suspended that obligation. They did a report up until filing for bankruptcy, as has been, I think, discussed earlier, but let me just speak to it briefly. Up until 2004, Northwest had complied with all of the covenants based on the numbers that were required in those agreements. In 2004, they went below those numerical requirements, but they relied on what's been characterized as a force majeure clause, which says that if there's changed business conditions or technological changes, they're excused from compliance with the hub or employment covenants, not the headquarters covenant. But there's a key proviso, and that proviso is provided that they have to use their best efforts to make sure that any reductions are substantially proportionate to reductions that they are making throughout their domestic system. So if they're going to make reductions here, they have to make them elsewhere in roughly the same proportion. And they did provide a detailed analysis in 2004, both to MAC and to the state, that documented both the fact that there were substantial changes in the business conditions that they were faced, September 11th, SARS, other changes in the airline industry that had occurred since 1991, but that the reductions that they had made were substantially proportionate to reductions that they've made throughout their domestic system. And so we believe, and they certainly believe, that they are in full compliance with those covenants due to the compliance with that force majeure provision. That's the 1991 transaction. When Northwest filed for bankruptcy in 2005, the airport was faced with a series of significant challenges. Northwest is clearly our largest tenant, our largest single payer of rent, and they have significant rights in bankruptcy to walk away from the obligations, to restructure loans, to cancel leases, to restructure their business so that they could hopefully emerge from bankruptcy. And they did, in fact, emerge, of course. But one of the aspects of that period of time in bankruptcy is that they approached the airport about restructuring all of the leases, the GO-15 obligations, for example. They could have potentially walked away from those obligations and forced the airport to deal with the collateral that we have, to deal with which are significant collateral, but clearly our primary objective was to get them to continue to make payments, and in fact they did continue to make payments throughout that. They also have substantial leases at the airport, which they could have rejected and walked away from. And so our board, and certainly with a great deal of public discussion, including a lot of legislative interest at the time in 2005, embarked on a strategy of willingness to renegotiate those obligations. And we did, in fact, restructure our terminal building leases, not just for Northwest, but for all the airlines, to lower our costs of operating for all the airlines. Clearly, in exchange for that, we received significant commitments from Northwest as part of their emergence from bankruptcy. They agreed to affirm all the GO-15 lease obligations, affirm their commitments to live up to the headquarters, hub, and employment covenants that are contained in those originally 1991 and now 2002 documents. They agreed to cure all of the
pre-petition defaults, they're called, that they had with us. And they agreed to cooperate to settle this significant lawsuit that the airport was in the middle of with the cities of Minneapolis, Richfield, and Eagan over the noise abatement soundproofing program. And ultimately, we did settle that litigation in part, in significant part, because of Northwest support. In addition to that, we looked at the commitment to maintain a hub and headquarters in the state, and our board determined that that certain of the rent reductions that we were prepared to provide Northwest as part of their emergence from bankruptcy would be tied to a renewal of their commitment to maintain the hub and the headquarters in the state or in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metropolitan area. And so a new hub and headquarters covenants were negotiated and actually tightened up in several significant respects. As Representative Lilly was mentioning, the definition of headquarters was actually changed and, from our perspective, improved in the 2007 document to mean not simply the principal office of the corporation, but also the principal office of any assignee of 90% of the assets of the company, to attempt to deal with a successor situation such as we're in now, where a company might try to take its assets and simply sell them to another entity. That was something that wasn't directly addressed, or it wasn't addressed quite as effectively in the previous definition. And we changed with the definition of not simply the principal office of the CEO, but also the CFO and the majority of its other senior management team members. And we also ratcheted up the number of flights that was required to maintain the hub. So we have that detail and the information that we provided you. The other significant point that I would make about these new hub and headquarters covenants is that they are tied to certain of the rent reductions that we provided the airline, in particular what's called concession revenue sharing and a reduction in rent on Building C, which some of you might know as the old Republic main base. It's the big maintenance facility you see as you're driving along 494 just on the south side of the airport. There was about $1.9 million in rent reduction that we gave to Northwest as part of their emergence from bankruptcy that snaps back if they violate the hub or the headquarters covenant. And similarly, their share in concession revenue sharing, which is approximately $10 million a year, but will escalate as concession revenue goes up through 2020 to as much as $15 or $18 million a year, that revenue sharing would also be eliminated in the event that they breach the hub or the headquarters covenant. So that's where we stand, Mr. Chairman. We believe that Northwest has legally binding commitments to the Airports Commission. We're aware of those commitments, and we're prepared to enforce them if there is a violation.
Mr. Chairman, if I might, just as a quick wrap-up, a couple of thoughts.
Mr. Hamill.
Number one, we have, as Tom has just said, reaffirmed all of our commitments, all the commitments that Northwest has made to Minneapolis, St. Paul, and Metropolitan Airports Commission. We will, in fact, receive, even with the reduction in some of the concessions revenue sharing, we're going to receive more than $1.3 billion of payments from Northwest Airlines over the next 14 years regarding the use of our facilities. We've enhanced the overall collateral package to strengthen that so that, in fact, we have more valuable assets available to us in the event that they should default for any reason whatsoever. Mr. Stempley mentioned Minneapolis-St. Paul as a lower-cost airport, and, in fact, we continue to be one of the lower-cost airports in the nation, the 30 large hub airports. That makes us attractive. It makes us a place where airlines wish to fly. We've also made provisions for competition in our overall planning efforts to make certain that we have gates available for new competitors that wish to enter the market. There's a sense that there are no gates available at Minneapolis because Northwest has them all tied up, when, in fact, we have reserved a half a dozen gates in our main terminal building and have gates available at Humphrey to make available to competing carriers if they so choose to serve Minneapolis-St. Paul. And Tom did, I just reiterate that we've committed to negotiate over a $127 million package to mitigate noise inflation for over 10,000 additional homes in the Minneapolis-St. Paul metro area. The bottom line is that I think we've attempted to do a pretty good job, and I think we have, of positioning ourselves comfortably to be a significant participant in this negotiation process with the airline. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Just a couple of clarifying questions, as long as we're clarifying things.
I'm not one to hide the ball. So this may sound like kind of a tough question, but it, from what you just said, Mr. Anderson, we already had a commitment of a hub and a headquarters, correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
And Mr. Anderson, we then got clarity. It was your term. We got greater clarification of what a headquarters was and better defined what a hub was. So we got what we already had, and in exchange, Northwest got $200 million in rent concessions over the next several years. Help me out.
The hub and headquarters
doesn't seem like a very, on its face, it doesn't seem like a very fair deal unless the unless I'm missing something. So,
as I tried to say, it wasn't simply an exchange for the reaffirming of the commitment. It was to keep a hub and a headquarters. In fact, I think the largest, a couple of things. The Northwest reaffirmed its obligation to pay the GO 15 obligations, reaffirmed its commitment on what now is the $245 million remaining obligation. They could have potentially walked away from that or walked away from some of that obligation through rejecting the lease or trying to restructure the loan in bankruptcy. We got them to affirm their terminal building agreement as well, and as you can imagine, that covers something like 99 gates and all the other support facilities they have in the airport, and so they recommitted to that agreement. In fact, we extended the lease term to 2020 as part of that, and they cured certain financial repulse. So, and then finally, they did, as part of the restructuring in the lease, it's been characterized as $200 million in concessions, but in fact there were concessions from them as well, and that money, while it could be looked at as a concession, actually provides some significant protection to the airport in terms of our relationship with the investment community. They looked at this agreement, the rating agencies, for example, and was very supportive of the changes we made. They didn't view it as simply concessions. They viewed it as a restructuring. So it wasn't just to get a reaffirmation of what we already had.
So they must have, I assume, Mr. Anderson, threatened to not reaffirm. Otherwise, why would you give them $200 million more? I assume during those bankruptcy discussions, they were saying they might just leave us hanging on the $245 million that they owed us, or they were going to leave us hanging on those contracts. Is that what happened?
They didn't threaten, Mr. Chairman, but it was clear that that was an option that was available to them. I would say they never threatened that that's what they were going to do.
Well, we may have to give some thought to what our options are with respect to Northwest then. It sounds like they're not real keen on honoring their obligations with the people of Minnesota. Granted, I understand that they're in tough times, but I don't like throwing more money. It's like beating them over the head with a checkbook or punishing a naughty child with a Hershey bar. It's not the way I like to do business, and I don't appreciate the way that they're doing business. Mr. Hamill.
Mr. Chairman, to put things kind of in a bit of a perspective, MAC was only one of probably a dozen or more various parties that were in negotiation with Northwest Airlines as part of their bankruptcy process. Boeing Aircraft Corporation, Airbus Industries, Bennington Manufacturers, leasing companies, their own employees, which you've heard a good deal about today. I mean, everyone who was engaged or involved in any aspect of this airline's operation was in a position where they were trying to secure their position, establish stability for themselves, and try to come up with a transaction that would, in fact, benefit the community in from our perspective, help this airline company survive, and come out of the other side as a viable, competitive enterprise providing jobs, air service, headquarters, and hubbing in Minnesota. So we're just one of a dozen or so various participants, and I think that the concessions that we made and the strengthening of the language and the reaffirming of the commitments that we had with Northwest Airlines, plus improvements and enhancements that took place, actually provide us with a much stronger, better package and, I think, a brighter future looking forward.
Now, I assume, I didn't read this as closely as you guys have, I assume if they breached, they still have an agreement with respect to employment figures, correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. If they breach that, we can still stop this rent reduction agreement as well, right?
Mr. Anderson? Mr. Chair, no. The employment covenant did not carry over into the lease. That is simply tied to the repayment of the $245 million loan.
Well, Mr. Anderson, if we were getting greater clarity with regard to the hub and the headquarters, why not that other, for many of us, that would be the perhaps the most important component
Why not get reaffirmation of that and have that tied to this $200 million in concessions or rent reductions?
All I can say, Mr. Chairman, that was part of the give and take of negotiation, and we felt, I think, to some extent, that the hub and the headquarters covered the issues of employment.
One final piece of clarity, and then I know that we've got a couple members, but it strikes me that the single most important thing that you folks control are the gates. And I know in other communities that have lost a hub, they've actually seen in a backhanded way some benefit because other carriers have come in. And in Kansas City, I think comes to mind, they actually saw a reduction in the average cost of the ticket price. So the traveling public got something. The gates, are they a component of this? If they breach their hub, their employment, or their headquarters, do you have the ability to take some of those gates and give them to other carriers?
If I can say, Mr.
Anderson,
it's not directly tied to the maintenance of the hub and the headquarters covenant. We have the right to take certain of the gates back today without regard to the breach of any agreement. Certain of the gates that Northwest has, I think it's 6 or 7 of them, we can simply take back on 60 days' notice. All of their gates are subject to what's called a use it or share it provision. So if they're not actually using the space, they have to make it available to someone else. So they can't simply cut back on activity and try to lock up the system. We have a very solid, what the industry calls use it or share it provision that requires the gates to be made available to their competitors. But at least as to these 6 gates, which are on what's called the D concourse, those could be taken immediately regardless of whether there's a breach of anything.
And Mr. Anderson, Northwest can't make their competitors, assuming that happened and you pulled back some gates, they can't make them fly red eyes or bad times, can they?
Well, as to the use it or share it,
right.
If they're using it, they have first priority. So if they're using it at 4 p.m., if they're during the rush hour, if you will, then there's somebody else would have to work in around them. But if they're not, they don't have a flight at that time, it's available at that time.
Right. Well, just final question, and then I'll leave you alone. So if they wanted to just, I'm assuming it's like rush hour. The best times are like 7 in the morning or 8, 9 o'clock in the morning and 4 in the afternoon, 5 in the afternoon. If they pulled back, they couldn't just hold the best times at all those gates that they currently have. And even though they're not fully using those gates, they'd have to give up some of those good times to their competitors. Would that be fair?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, Northwest Airlines has to have a gate, an airplane parked at the gate during those peak hours of the day and has to be scheduled for a flight that operates during that time frame. They could not simply park an airplane at the gate, let it sit there for 4 hours to lock up the gate to prevent a competitor from entering the market.
I understand that. I'm just I'm assuming anyway that they can't just take the really good times, 7, 8, 9 in the morning, 4, 5, 6 in the afternoon, get rid of all the other flights for people's convenience over the midday, late at night, and leave those flights just available to other carriers that might want to come into the market, because it would be very difficult if, you know, JA Airlines wanted to come in and we didn't have any ability to fly good times if those were all locked in. I assume if Northwest starts to back off, you have the ability to capture some of those good times of the day to fly for other carriers.
If Northwest has a lease for that gate and they're occupying that gate and using it during those times, that's their obligation to satisfy the obligation of the lease itself. Except for the 6 gates that Tom talked about on the D concourse, those can be taken back by the Airports Commission and made available to any competing carrier. Now let's put this in perspective a bit. We have not denied a carrier access to the airport during peak hours or off-peak hours of the Minneapolis-St. Paul Airport, to the best of my knowledge, to date. In other words, people who have needed to operate the airport have been accommodated one way or another, and we've worked with carriers to make that accommodation successful. So I have no concerns at this point in time about a new carrier coming into the Minneapolis-St. Paul market, and I mean we'll have access to gates in the terminal building during 90% of the hours of the day.
Okay, thank you. Representative LaForce.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I had a couple questions for Mr. Anderson to help me clarify this as well. It sounds to me that essentially the remedy for a breach of the covenants would be an acceleration of the bond payment, and I know there's a little bit more to that, but essentially there would be you'd exercise an option to accelerate, and there would be a loss of some of the benefits contained in the recently renegotiated covenants with respect to revenue sharing and rent reductions, et cetera, et cetera. Do I have that right? Am I on the right track with that, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Chair, Representative LaForest, that's correct.
Okay. And again, we talked about that as a sole remedy, so other contractual remedies, for example, like specific performance, would be unavailable to the MAC if it ever reached that point. Is that true as well?
That's right, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Representative.
Reading through here, Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry, I had a couple other questions. Looking at the force majeure clauses in the documents in Exhibit 1 and Exhibit 2, and if I can, in subpart 2 that begins with from reducing or changing, I should, for the benefit of everyone, starts out with a section that says force majeure provision under the GO-15 bonds. The above shall not be deemed to prevent lessee or its affiliates in subpart 2 from changing, reducing or changing its Minnesota deployment, et cetera, in response to force majeure or business conditions. And I had a question for that, but then I wanted to turn to the December 28, 2007 agreement. It looks like you've altered the force majeure definition, and I'm wondering, did the December 28, 2007 force majeure provision replace and supplant the previous one, Mr. Anderson?
Mr. Anderson? No, Mr. Chair, they're both, Representative, they're both still in play. The first one reference applies to the GO-15
okay.
covenants, and the second applies to the terminal building lease covenants.
Okay. Got it. Mr. Chairman, I had two more brief questions, if you would. I appreciate that. Mr. Anderson, in the force majeure clause that under the 2007 agreement talks about the force majeure provision being in effect with respect to shortages of energy, and I'm wondering, is that defined in the agreement, or was there any discussion outside the four corners of this document between the parties as to what that might mean?
Mr. Anderson, I don't believe so, Mr. Chair. It's not defined. Those are not defined terms. I don't think there was any discussion.
Representative LaForest.
And my final question, Mr. Chairman, for Mr. Anderson is going back to the 2002 agreement and that subpart 2 I talked about. I'm sorry to make you flip pages around, but it talks about in response to force majeure, and then it looks like there's an offsetting independent clause that talks about business conditions. That seems to be rather broad, and I'm wondering if there was any discussion or if this has been invoked at all by Northwest Airlines and exactly what is meant by business conditions, because it seems to me to be a very broad term as I read it.
Mr. Anderson.
Mr. Chair, that has been invoked by Northwest in 2004 and currently to justify failure to comply with the Minnesota Employment Covenant. They indicated that, in their view, changing business conditions that they identified as September 11th, the war in Iraq, SARS, have significantly changed the business environment in which Northwest is prepared to operate. So I think it's fair to say that that covenant is not just force majeure. It's force majeure, business conditions, technological changes, or regulatory changes. And they have satisfied that. And then, at least in 2004, went on to that second part of the clause to establish that they've made their best efforts to make sure that the reductions were proportionate throughout their system.
Representative LaForest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you.
And can we agree, Mr. Anderson and Representative LaForest, as long as we're having sort of a law school soliloquy or a dialogue here, that this clause should not apply if it is a condition created by one of the parties? That's standard black letter law, right, Mr. Anderson?
I haven't thought about that, Mr. Chair, but certainly force majeure is things outside the control of the entity. I wouldn't apply it to a voluntary merger situation, that's right.
Well, let me spell out what I'm talking about. The Northwest has taken advantage of this clause a few times to reduce the number of their employees, arguing that acts of God or things outside of their control, 9/11 or SARS, have been caused them the ability to reduce their number of employees. In this instance, this action, the possible sale of Northwest Airlines to Delta, is something within their control. They are creating the condition. It shall not, by black letter law school basic law, shall not serve as a reason for them to take advantage of this clause and reduce jobs. That's Professor Atkins will now get off his high horse, if they try that, I assume that MAC and I assume that the state of Minnesota will not find that an acceptable argument and will argue specifically against it. We have a couple other members on our
on our panel, Representative Burns, and then Representative Zellers, that had questions or comments. Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we've had a good discussion today, and we've learned a lot. Certainly, folks from the IAM and the flight attendants have spoke to us about what it's like to work at Northwest, especially under these tough times. You're having to go through a bankruptcy, seeing the number of their coworkers decline, actually having to have their pay reduced, which is just an amazing thing, and I can't imagine having to go through something like that myself, including people who've invested their entire career in this company. I think a lot of Minnesotans, you know, would look at this environment, the airline industry, and say, boy, I'm glad I make my living somewhere else. This is really a tough place to be. And yet at the same time, we have people like Representative Lilly and his coworkers who, thousands of them, put heart and soul into the company and work hard. So that's the environment. It's a really tough environment. And on top of that, we've heard very difficult relations between labor and management when the representative from the IAM testified. So that's what we're working with. And you know that better than we do because you're there every day at the mat. My question for you is, we're looking at the now. We're looking at covenants, promises, agreements. I would ask the committee, ask all of us to look, what's the future of the airline industry? And from your position at the MAC, where do you believe we're going to be in 5 years? Is fuel prices just going to take this whole industry down company by company, or we're going to see more and more mergers? How can you do...
Mr. Chairman...
Who wants to take the crystal ball and run with it?
Representative Burns, let me divide this into two pieces. Let me start first by telling you that I believe that Minneapolis-St. Paul... First of all, I believe there's going to be a continued viable airline industry in the United States of America and around the world. Fuel is an interesting feature from the standpoint that gas prices go up. They go up for everybody. It's not more expensive for Norfolk Southern to buy gas than it is for Southwest or United or anyone else. So they're all having to wrestle with this monster of increased fuel costs. And of course, aircraft consume just tremendous amounts of fuel as part of their operation. So some of these cost structures are impacting all the airlines at the same time. Believing that there will be an ongoing airline industry because this country is based upon its ability to connect and to travel and to do business. People are going to have to continue to travel, and it may become more expensive, but there's still a core group of people who must use the industry. So I believe that so long as there's air transportation in America, the Minneapolis-St. Paul Metropolitan Airports Commission, MSP, as an airport, will have a continued concentration of traffic and activity. We have 19 Fortune 500 companies in the state of Minnesota. One of the reasons that they are able to be here is because they can connect anywhere in the United States, domestic system, nonstop to all any major city or medium-sized city in the country, and they can travel worldwide to Asia and to Europe with good frequencies out of our airport. So if you believe that, in fact, in spite of the economy, in spite of the cost of fuel, aviation is not going to disappear, Minneapolis-St. Paul, we believe, will continue to be a viable, competitive hub based on our cost structures, based on the moving money of the facility, the commitments that we have from the airline industry and Northwest in particular, what we expect to have in the future with Delta as part of these obligations by Northwest. Now, the broader question, what the future of the industry overall holds for the 5 to 10 year horizon, I think your judgment is as good as mine. I can think by my previous response, I would say that I believe that aviation continues to face difficult challenges. There may be some additional consolidation. There will probably be more additional bankruptcies. There'll be reorganizations. New airlines will appear on the market. Other carriers will go away because, as I described in my opening remarks today, 160 airline companies have come and gone in the last 30 years. I don't see that scenario changing significantly until ultimately the airlines can raise the price of tickets and charge what I consider to be a more reasonable fee to travel across this country and around the world. Having said that, those fees go up. Passenger activity goes down. There has to be some balance somewhere in the national and the world economy regarding air transportation. But the industry will continue to struggle with trying to find that balance, that equilibrium, and I believe it will persevere.
Representative Burns, any further questions?
Just a comment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
the first part of your answer, that's exactly what I want to hear, in that the a vibrant airport, whether that's a hub, and I hope it will be a hub for the combined company or something else, is absolutely important to this state, and I appreciate your comments along those lines. And I also appreciate the fact that MAC is government. You are the government running the airport, and I appreciate your acknowledgement of how important it is to manage well and be competitive as an airport, so we can attract and retain a hub or other significant services. And the second part, you know, I was hoping you had the answer to where we're going to be, and I certainly respect that. That's something we're all going to have to wait and see. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I just kind of take advantage since I have the gavel for a second. I don't usually do this either, but you run a great airport. It's really quite a place. It's, you know, it's a city. They have a police force. I wish they wouldn't write tickets for us people on the ramp, but that's another issue. No, you run a great airport. It's really quite an amazing place. Representative Zellers?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Anderson, you know, the reason we're here today, supposedly, are the two bills in front of us, 4207, 4015. And if you had a minute to look over them, I'd appreciate knowing what it is in these bills that's going to give you more or less teeth, more authority, a bigger stick, a meaner tone to your... sorry, Representative Wardlow and I are playing a little... Keep your head still one minute there. Now, he and I are bobbing and weaving with you. The bills before us, are they going to give you more or less authority? I mean, you know, the question I've been asking all day is, what are we here going to do with the laws we pass that's going to make it more or less easier for you to enforce the covenants, and again, since it was law school day on campus here, what more or less are we doing with these bills?
Mr. Chairman,
Mr. Hamilton, and I think this will be the question we'll take, and then we'll go to those bills, Representative Zellers, would be the other than one final question.
Well, I have right. One other follow-up to the, I'm going to get the price.
fair enough. Mr. Hamilton.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, I've read the language of both of the bills that you will be addressing in a few moments, and I understand that you want to hold a hard line, and you want to basically make this airline accountable and commit to its obligations. We, our board, has authorized the staff and has approved a negotiated arrangement with Northwest Airlines, and as of today, our intention is to enforce the provisions of those leases, and that's exactly what we intend to do. I think that, quite frankly, we have the power and the authority, I think we've demonstrated that ability over the last 30 years, to enforce these provisions and to examine every bit of new information that comes to us regarding any discussions that we have presently or in the future with either Northwest or Delta Airlines. But the bottom line is, we have language, we have a legally binding document, and we are prepared to enforce those provisions if necessary.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, say it goes like we've been discussing here today. Northwest is going to breach covenants, agreements, whatever it may be. We've had all kinds of dollar amounts thrown around as to what's owed and what's going to be a billion, a half a billion, what's going to be paying back loans. What is it? Say everything's breached. What's the dollar amount? I mean, I think that's what we're supposed to be getting to the end of the discussion here. Is if it's a, because as I understand it from last week, the $245 million, they're not gonna drop a check in the state's checking account, and we're gonna have $245 million to spend. But this is bonds that are gonna be paid back. So the number I'm looking for, because we've had kind of a moving target here of what if again all these doomsday scenarios come out and they leave and break contracts, what's the dollar amount?
Judge Hamill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the $245 million, of course, is reduced with each quarterly payment, so depending on when this all happens, they would, in fact, have to pay the $245 million. Now, Tom can talk about the process associated with that, but that's the dollar amount as we sit here today. As far as the other $200 or so million, they would simply not receive the benefit of reduced rents on their facilities at the airport, nor would they enjoy the revenue-sharing portion of the agreement. So they would not receive those dollars over the next 14 years as part of this agreement. But the actual dollar amount to be paid as of today is very close to $245 million.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is that that's per year or over the 14 years?
That's the entire obligation of the MAC based on these agreements.
For 14 years.
If I can just restate it, Mr. Chairman, make sure I heard it right.
Mr. Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It's roughly 10, growing to as much as $18 million per year through 2020. So you can make some assumptions about that and say over the court between now and 2020, that's a roughly $200 million increase in rent that they would experience.
Thank you for indulging my mathematics.
Thank you, Representative Zellers. Representative Anderson and Representative Mason.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess the question that I have, I probably should have asked last week, but since we aren't going to be hearing from Kathleen Nelson, I'm just wondering at what point are we going to have a chance to kind of examine what happens if we don't do the merger, what kind of cost will that have on jobs, and are we going to have a chance to have that conversation with Northwest and also with the employees, too, if they've done some analysis of that, of what happens if a merger of whatever kind doesn't happen. What are we looking at? I'm just trying to think long term. You know, we're really focusing right now on this merger with Delta. Well, if that doesn't happen, then what next? I mean, what do we need to prepare ourselves for? And I'm just looking ahead that way. Are we going to have some time to kind of have that conversation at all?
Thank you, Representative Anderson. And I'd ask these gentlemen if they want to pull out that crystal ball again. They may be best situated as far as folks that are on the state's team to address that, as opposed to, you know, some folks sitting here. The short answer is yes. Do I have the answer today? No. But if Mr. Hamill, I assume it'll be Mr. Hamill, right, Mr. Anderson? All right. Mr. Hamill, you want to take a 30-second shot at it?
I that's where we are today. I mean, we are an airport with a dominant hub carrier, Northwest Airlines. If this merger does not go forward and become a completed deal, I'm assuming Northwest Airlines continues to compete and operate its current system of aircraft and its complete network of services that the cities it serves. There may be some adjustments to the airline that they'll have to make because, in fact, they're constantly adjusting and sizing the airline. But in fact, we are a single dominant carrier hub today, and if there's no merger, we'll remain in the position that we're in today with some, I think, fluctuation in the future. But I believe Minneapolis-St. Paul remains a very important, viable, high-yield hub for air service. Oh, a good point. Some numbers. We take a look at the overall passenger, connecting passenger and origination passenger activity in Minneapolis-St. Paul over the last, say, 5 or 6 years. In 2000, this airport had 15.67 million total passengers. That's the enplanement, people getting on board the airplane and leaving. So 5 years later, in 2007, we increased from 15.67 to 17 million passengers a year. This is as Northwest Airlines as we know it is today. In other words, the airline overall has grown over those years. It has actually peaked a little bit over 18 million passengers in 2005. But we've seen a fluctuation where there was a decline, an increase, and a leveling off. We think that kind of movement, that kind of activity will continue in the future, but we believe that this hub is a very important enterprise for this airline and for other airlines that wish to compete in this marketplace.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. With Mr. Hamill, I appreciate your optimism on this. I guess I'd like to have some time, though, spent, and perhaps Northwest can get in contact with me directly. But I guess I'd like to see what their projections are as far as this, you know, all of this conversation is crystal ball. Even just talking about the merger itself is crystal ball. So, you know, when we're talking about that, I guess I'd like to see the other side of it, too, of what are the consequences if this doesn't happen, because I think we owe it to everybody. You know, our crystal ball projections are that there would be 1,000 jobs lost, okay, and we don't know if that's going to be in Minnesota, Atlanta, or where that's going to be. Well, what's the other side of it? If the merger doesn't happen, what are the potential job losses there, too? So I guess I'd like to have some folks give some projections and ideas of what that might be so we know what we're getting ourselves into overall.
That's an excellent point, Representative Anderson. Representative Mason?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Hamill, and Mr. Anderson, this is kind of a follow-up to Representative Stern's question. And I'm operating on the two things that are important to me. One is the importance of air travel to our businesses and the public as a whole. And I remember from one of the conventions that we had, the proximity to the airport is in direct proportion to your economic success. What you had mentioned was the volatility since the deregulation. In your opinion, can we keep on going? Let me rephrase that. Do you think airlines in our country can be successful in a global marketplace at the rate we are working with our airlines right now since deregulation?
Mr. Hamilton?
Mr. Chair?
Can you answer that one in 30 seconds or less?
I can't. I think the volatility is an expression of the competition in the marketplace. And the low-cost carrying in the market with lower cost structures and so forth raise havoc within the industry, but they also challenge the legacy carriers to reduce costs and become more efficient. All of that has happened and continues to happen and will both domestically and internationally, except that we're now competing with the world. So it's not just American, United, Continental, Delta, Northwest Airlines fighting with one another. It's dealing with all the airline companies around the world. And I think that the marketplace will continue to be highly volatile.
Thank you, Mr. Hamill. With that, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time this afternoon. As far as the plan for the Representative Paymar is here, the chair will move House File 4015, be recommended pass, refer to the Committee on Rules, the recommendation that it be sent on to local government and metropolitan affairs. I think for purposes of trying to move through the two bills, they're relatively similar. What we'll do is we'll take up House File 4015. I will go up and hang out with Representative Paymar, so if people have questions about either bill, they're welcome to raise those questions at the time. We're going to formally act on 4015, and then we will take up 4207, which is my bill, after that. So with that, I will turn it over to Vice Chair Lilly. And there is an amendment, as I understand it, Representative Paymar House File, or HDA 780. Is that an author's amendment?
Yes, it is, Mr.
Chair, I'll move the House, the HDA 780 amendment. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none.
Mr. Chair, I do have an oral amendment to the amendment, if that would be in order at this
okay.
point.
Mr. Chair,
just a point of clarification. I'm assuming that Chair Paymar is the author of 4015. Because in the copy we have, it shows here that Ben Hornstein is the author of the bill. So just as it's a technical thing, but just so I got the right one here.
You do. Representative Zellers, Representative Hornstein has a family medical issue, and Representative Paymar is here as a co-author to present the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Paymar, to your oral amendment.
Mr. Chair, members, on line 1.9 after the word and, insert the word surrender.
So the line would read obligation.
I'm sorry. Let me backtrack here. So maybe need some staff assistance here. On line 1.8, after the word repayment. No, just yeah. Okay. Line 1.9, after the word and, insert the word surrender.
Okay. And that is of the HDA 780 amendment that has been adopted. So it would be the line would read obligations and surrender previously granted, and so forth. Is that correct?
That's correct.
The chair will move that. All in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Seeing none. Representative Paymar, does that put the bill in the shape in which you desire to move with it?
It does, Mr. Chair.
All right. With that, I will join you there at the table with my bill, and we'll look forward to questions and testimony. Representative Lilly, if you'll take the gap.
Representative Paymar, maybe you could tell us a little bit about your bill and Representative Hornstein's bill and yours.
Mr. Chair, thank you very much, and I'll be very brief in just making a few introductory remarks. I know you've had a long hearing. I sat in on part of it and unfortunately had to be in the Finance Committee for the majority of it. And as Chair Atkins says, Representative Hornstein had a family emergency. We're co-authors of the bill. So let me just say, just real briefly, just some remarks. I believe that the employees of Northwest Airlines have worked very hard for this at this airline, as you heard testimony this morning. And I think the taxpayers of this state have bent over backwards to help this airline, and this legislature has repeatedly helped this airline, and now the decision appears to be made. The MAC and the state of Minnesota, as you know, have binding commitments with Northwest Airlines tied to the 1991 state financing package regarding the maintenance of a hub, headquarters, and Minnesota employment levels. These members are covenants. These are legally binding agreements. The state financing package would not have happened without these covenants. And I believe that our constituents expect nothing short of insisting that Northwest Airlines be held accountable for abiding by to these covenants. So why this bill? Representative Hornstein and I have been repeatedly concerned, as I think most Minnesotans have since this, the pending announcement. And if you listen to Doug Steenland, he publicly stated that, quote, that keeping major operations here is in compliance with the spirit of the loan. Those are his words, that keeping major operations here is in compliance with the spirit of the loan. Well, I don't know how stupid Mr. Steenland thinks we are here. This bill ensures that the covenants are honored. This bill ensures that the MAC acts on behalf of the taxpayers. And to be blunt, I don't trust Northwest Airlines, nor do I trust Delta to do the right thing. And I, to be honest with you, and to be blunt, I don't actually trust the MAC. From Mr. Checkey and Mr. Wilson to Mr. Anderson and Mr. Steenland, the workers of Northwest Airlines have been assaulted, the customers have been treated poorly, and the state has been taken for a ride. And now Mr. Steenland is going to walk away with $11 million and $26 million in stock options, and the state of Minnesota is potentially out millions of dollars. I heard Mr. Hurst testify before this committee last week, and he seemed to be making a veiled threat. Even though he can't negotiate on behalf of Delta, he implied that if we play ball with Delta, there may be a major presence here. I have nothing against negotiations, and I hope MAC can proceed with those negotiations, but let's make sure that we aren't taken advantage of again. And that's what the bill does, and that's what the amendment does, that on the covenant enforcement, it requires that the Metropolitan Airports Commission shall not enter into any agreement to modify or amend or eliminate the covenants referenced in this section of the bill without the agreement first being approved by law. In other words, the legislature would have final approval. And that's the bill. I know Representative the Chair has a similar bill and maybe even a stronger bill, but this is the Hornstein Tamar bill.
Thank you, Representative Paymar, and thank you for your comments on the employees. They're appreciated. We have Professor Pender wants to offer some thoughts, and then we have some questions as well. So,
Mr. Pender. Mr. Chair and members, I think the oral amendment needs to have a word added to the end of it. I think it should the adding the word surrender, I think the word of should be added after it, so it's surrender of. To make it match, we add it after it, so it's surrender of, to make it match the line right up above where it talks about require repayment of, just for parallel construction.
Mr. Chair, I will move that.
Any questions to the amendment? Seeing none, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed? Amendment, oral amendment adopted. Anything further, Professor Pender? He's probably going to want more money for this. I think.
Actually, professors make less, I think.
Oh, they do. I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry to insult you, sir. Representative Zeller?
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Representative Paymar, that's to my question. That on that line, you're going to ask them to surrender previously granted rent reduction. So we're going to go back in time to any rent reduction they got, and it would be a cash payment then to the state, or to the MAC?
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, I believe that would be to the MAC, since they were the ones that granted the rent reduction. But I
would. Representative Zeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So do we know, do we have a dollar amount that we're going to ask of them?
Mr. Chair, as I understand it, and I could be off here, I believe those lease benefits are $68 million.
Mm-hmm. Representative Zeller?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So, as far as the original covenant, are we adding, is this an added provision then that was not in the previously negotiated covenant or the original covenant or the whatever it was, the 07 or 06, whatever, the renegotiated covenant?
This is part of, Mr. Chair, this is part of the, as far as I can recall, this is part of the renegotiated covenant I don't have the exact year, but this was the renegotiated covenant.
Representative Zeller.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. So the renegotiated covenant, I believe, was 07, and we might have to get Mr. Anderson or one of those guys back up here, or 2002, amended by Exhibit A here is the amended. So I guess what I'm just trying to get at is how far, if this wasn't a part of the original covenant, if it was part of the renegotiated covenant.
Representative Tamar. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I'm sorry. I'm just trying to figure out the whole point is here that if Northwest has an obligation, they're supposed to fulfill it. And if that's what we're here to do, if we're going to go back now and add on, by the way, we're mad at you, we're going to punish you and slap you, I just want to get the dollar amount we're going to slap them for or hit them for, and then how far back we're going to go to the renegotiated or the original.
Representative Paymar.
Mr. Chair, Representative Zeller, this would be our intent that this goes back to the original covenant and post-covenant that have been renegotiated by the state, by the MAC, with Northwest Airlines since the original financial package agreement.
Thank you,
Mr. Chairman. Okay, if we're adding in new language, I think we're, no offense to the trials and lawyers in the room, but I think personally then we're going to give them an opportunity to go back and sue because technically then we've changed the contract as well. But not a lawyer, and I'm sure you guys will bill at a rate that will make sure that everybody in the lawyering community is happy. But if the agreement or the idea here is to get the money owed to us, which I completely agree with you on, that's what we should do, not make it more difficult, again, for full employment for the lawyers, because I think that's what we're going to do if we start changing the agreement as well. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Representative De La Forest.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Representative Tamar, I had a question similar to Representative Zeller's. As I read the amended and restated Third Amendment to the operating agreement, it appears to say that the sole remedy is either a reduction of revenue sharing in the current year in which the airline stands in breach, or apparently if there's a breach of for three consecutive years, there's a permanent forfeiture of revenue sharing, and all those appear to be prospective type of remedies, whereas your bill appears to be back in time, as Representative Zeller's noted, to previously granted rent reductions, and I'm not sure we can do that, and I offer that in a spirit of cooperation. It seems to me that your bill would avoid some constitutional issues if you eliminated reference to previously granted rent reductions and just referenced rent reductions, because I do agree with the public policy underpinning your bill that we want the MAC to pursue the full range of legal remedies if there's a breach of the covenant. So I said I offer the constructive criticism unless I'm reading the bill incorrectly, but that's how I read it.
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the way that the syntax, I think, is a little difficult, but it references previously granted rent reductions. This is the 2007 agreement that was entered into as they emerged from bankruptcy. It's roughly, I think the folks from MAC would describe it as about $200 million in rent reduction. That is the target of the bill. In addition to those outstanding balances of what I think it's been referenced as $245 million. As I visited with Representative Hornstein, I think that was the target of his bill.
Representative De La Forest.
What?
Representative Atkins, just to clarify, you meant by the target of rent reductions, those that would be going forward or those that have already, that Northwest has already enjoyed previously?
Chair Atkins.
Chair Representative De La Forest, to the extent, I think the way that the bill is actually phrased, the way that it says is pursue full enforcement of the agreement. So to the extent that prior to 2007 there were any rent reductions that we would be able to access, I would expect that they would be pursued. But I know for certain that Representative Hornstein was concerned about the 2007 arrangement where there was a couple hundred million dollars in rent reductions that were granted. And the hub and headquarters possibly being breached. So that was specifically a target. If there are others, then the language of the bill provides for full enforcement to the extent that there are.
Okay. Representative De La Forest. And Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, perhaps we have a disagreement. I guess, to my view, if there are rent reductions that have already been enjoyed, I don't think they could be reached more than likely, perhaps, but I don't think so, and I think they'd be limited to the prospective type remedies, but maybe that's just a little bit different viewpoint that you and I have.
Mr.
Chair Atkins.
Representative De La Forest, I think we're getting to the next point. The purpose of the bill just says full enforcement. You and I are now talking about what a fact finder, a judge, or a jury may find in the event that it went down that course. I think the purpose of the bill is very straightforward, which is just says full enforcement of the agreement.
Thank you. Any final comments on your bill?
Chair, to ensure success of Representative Paymar's bill, before I cloud up the issue with what my bill does, I'd renew my motion that House File
4015
be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Rules with a recommendation that it be sent to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs.
Chair Atkins has renewed the motion as amended. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed? You're on your way.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you for your patience, Chair Paymar.
Chair
Atkins?
I would move House File 4207 be recommended passed, refer to the Committee on Rules with a recommendation that it be sent to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs.
We have Chair Atkins' bill before us. Any questions, or would you like to make some comments, sir?
Just very briefly, Mr. Chair, and then I do have one fellow here to provide some brief testimony. But if you understood the Paymar bill, which seeks, or the Hornstein bill that seeks full enforcement, this does the same. It's no different than the same sort of remedy that would be required of any other Minnesota business or any other Minnesotan if they breached a contract, and that it provides for all of the possible remedies. Frankly, the previous bill is a little bit more limiting. This says that in the event that incidental or consequential or other damage are found to be available, that we would seek to fully enforce that as well. I understand that there may be an argument, perhaps from my esteemed colleague, Representative De La Forest, or Representative Zellers, or Representative Burns, or Anderson, or whomever, that perhaps those damages would not be available under these contracts. My bill simply says that in the event that they are, that they ought to be pursued, just like they would against any other Minnesota business or any other Minnesotan. And I'm going to engage in a little bit of law school effort here, but there's at least a few bases on which I believe that those additional damages would be available, in spite of the best efforts of Northwest to limit their exposure to basically paying. They breach the contract. In the event that they breach the contract, they argue that they just pay the money back. That is unlike just about any other contract that any of us would ever enter into. If we enter into a contract and we breach it, not only do we have to potentially pay the money back, but if there's damages to the other side, we have to pay those. I'll give you an example. I hire somebody to come in and fix my furnace, pay him $2,000 to do that, and he messes it up and the place burns down, and I suffer $300,000 in damages. My house is all burnt down. The measure of damages would not be getting back $2,000. It would be the $2,000 plus whatever damage you did to my house, just like any other Minnesota business would be responsible to do. In this case, that's what Northwest Airlines, that's the same standard that Northwest Airlines and Delta ought to be held to. It's that straightforward. The little bit of law school point that I would make is there's three points. One is the I believe that when Northwest was renegotiating with the MAC in 2007 as they emerged from bankruptcy, I think the facts will show that they were in fact engaged at that time with discussions with Delta. They had potentially some thoughts about breaching an agreement that they had not even yet entered into. And I'm curious, I don't want to make that as an allegation. I'm just, my sense is that these discussions may well have preceded the negotiations and the final contract terms that went into in December of 2007. And if we find that to be the case when we fully seek to enforce our remedies, if that's the case, then I don't think they were dealing in good faith with us. And there is a requirement that you deal in good faith. Even before I passed my law on good faith, there was a requirement that you act in good faith when you enter into contracts. And if they weren't acting in good faith, then they shouldn't enjoy the very limited remedies that are in this contract. It should revert back to typical contract damages, which would be things like consequential and incidental damages. What that means is the full measure of damages. Maybe that's it. We've seen experts that have said we could see $70 million in loss from the income at the headquarters, 1,000 jobs. And the indirect losses, Commissioner McElroy and others will tell you that that's generally 2 to 2.5 times what the direct losses are. To the extent those damages are foreseeable, you're talking a couple hundred million dollars, $300 million. In damage to the state of Minnesota. When we entered into this contract, we did it because we wanted those jobs and we wanted all the good spin-off of those jobs. People spending money, providing for vendors and restaurants and retailers to do well. Otherwise, why would we have entered into this agreement with them? The final point is the in the event that the remedy is found to be unconscionable, that is also a way that you can get away from the specific limitations on damages. And to me, this strikes me as an unconscionable relief in the event that Northwest breaches its contract with Minnesota. So in sum, just simply looking to hold Northwest to the same obligation that we would hold any other Minnesota business or any other Minnesotan if they breach the contract. My hope is that they and Delta will continue to be good neighbors, that they will honor their agreements, that Delta will show up, that they will in fact leave the airport and come to Minnesota and talk to us about what sort of assurances they can make. But with that, I would appreciate your support of the bill in the event that there is a breach, that we fully enforce that on behalf of the people of Minnesota. With that, I'll stand for any questions that people may have.
Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have one comment for you, Mr. Chair, and then a question. First, I appreciate you holding these hearings. It's very important to the people of Minnesota that we talk about this and about what's happening. And I appreciate your involvement of this committee, which is clearly the place that we should have this discussion. And I also very much appreciate the effort at accountability. When people make promises and sign agreements, we need to live with them. And I think legislation certainly is a step in the right direction to do that, and is appropriate. The other part of the comment I wanted to say before my question is that I hope that as we go forward, this committee and maybe other committees, maybe the tax committee, will also look at not only accountability and enforcement and keeping people to their promises, but in doing things that help increase our business climate in the state overall, not just for keeping Northwest here and a hub here and a headquarters here potentially, but making sure we can grow a good job. And that's just a comment. But my question for you is the lines 2.7, 2.8, 2.9 about the incidental, consequential, liquidated, and other damages. And I understand this is you want to make this option available if it's one that exists. But to you as chair of the Commerce Committee, do you believe at this point, with the knowledge you have, that there would be incidental, consequential, liquidated, or any other damages that would be available at this point?
Chair Atkins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Burns, I will make 2 points to answer your question first. Absolutely, there are consequential damages. No question. We would not have given $500 million, actually it was more than that over the course of the years,
just for the sake of giving that money, if there were not enormous direct and indirect and foreseeable expected damages on job loss and all of the impact that that has on Minnesota's economy. This may well be the single most important economic event, single most detrimental economic event in Minnesota's history. That's saying something. So yeah, I think there's enormous damages available. And in the event that the legal theories that I set forward earlier are in fact the case, then yes, those damages will be available. I'm not here to sit as the fact finder or the judge. I'm just saying let's fully enforce the contract. If those damages are available, we should seek them. Your first point, actually I was hoping that question would come because I've got a surprise witness. The past president of the Minnesota High Tech Association, because my mama taught me that if you're going to come in and criticize something, you better come in with some solutions as well. So I've got Todd Hochschild, who also works for Thomson Reuters, who's got some brief testimony to talk to you about the sense being that if this does happen, is there a way from a commerce and labor perspective that we can react to it in a positive way? And with that, Mr. Chair, if I could indulge the, and I know Representative Burns has the floor, but I'd like to hear next from Mr. Hochschild.
Representative Burns.
I just one quick follow-up on the first part. Do you believe that a cause of action exists now? I mean, as certainly a fine lawyer, do you believe that...
lawyer.
Do you believe that this... Because I certainly, there's consequences. There's no doubt about that. I agree with you on that. But legally, if we put this into law, is this something that can be acted upon? Essentially, someone can be victorious in court.
Mr. Chair, Representative Burns.
Jackins.
I don't think we have enough information yet to know. There's the concept, as you know, of anticipatory repudiation of a contract. If they've taken steps that have gone so far as to be the equivalent of a breach of contract, then yes, we just simply don't know that yet. That's why we've asked Mr. Steenland and Mr. Anderson to join us as well. We'll look forward to it. They've supplied, Northwest, to their credit, has supplied some documents. We want to review those. Delta has not. We want to review those. And then we can figure out, the actual lawyers that represent the state of Minnesota and the MAC can figure that out.
Representative Burns.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Mr. Hochschild?
Correct.
Can you please state your name for the record and go ahead when you're ready, sir.
Thank you. My name is Todd Hochschild. I'm a vice president with Thomson Reuters, and I'm the immediate past chair and current board member of the Minnesota High Tech Association. The Minnesota High Tech Association fights for the Minnesota technology economy. Organizations such as 3M, IBM, Honeywell, Lockheed Martin, Starkey Labs, Seagate, Quest, Unisys are all members, in addition to 325 other member companies in Minnesota. So our position on the technology economy is very important to us. With the proposed merger, if it goes through, there are very few desirable benefits directly for Minnesota in this. The loss of another corporate headquarters is devastating and has ripple effects. However, with this change also comes opportunity. Minnesota can and should become the technology headquarters for a combined entity had it go through. There has been no irreversible decision made yet on that between the airlines, and this is something that we should fight for. Benefits of this solution, to look at this, is that it's a chance for the legislature to take a strong leadership position when it comes to this technology matter and the economy. This is above traditional squabbling. It's not a lawsuit. It does not provoke confrontation with Delta, and it's a great way to solve a problem for Minnesota. NWA, current technology organization, is industry leading for the airline industry. They were one of the first with self-service kiosks, automated flight information onto your mobile devices. They face all the e-commerce challenges of e-tickets early on. They have a strong technology footprint here. A 335,000 square foot data center. They have a 278,000 square foot flight training center. And then they have the automated flight training for the A320, the A330, and soon to be the Boeing 787. When you look at Minnesota, employee recruiting, retention, it's much easier in Minnesota than it is other metro areas.
Technology wages here are lower than the average for the nation. Housing prices are lower. We have less congestion, and we have a great feeder system, primarily due to a lot of the efforts of the legislature in supporting STEM education and fueling our pipeline for the future workforce. To talk a little bit about the technology industry in Minnesota and what it really means. In Minnesota, it's 128,000 high-tech workers in the state of Minnesota. We had 600 jobs grow between 2005 and 2006 when many states had a decline in jobs. High-tech firms employ 56 of every 1,000 private sector workers in Minnesota. That's 15th in the nation. High-tech workers in the state earn an average wage of $71,600 per year. That's 22nd in the U.S., and that's 69% more than the average Minnesota private sector wage. Minnesota had a high-tech bankroll, payroll for all of its high-tech workers around $92 billion in 2006. So you can see that we're talking about a lot of money and a very strong foundation for our high technology corridor here in Minnesota itself. I can take questions.
Thank you, Mr. Halschel. Representative Wargo?
I remember an email about this. Was that from you?
No, I did not send you an email.
Because I have an email that describes exactly what you're saying.
Okay.
I'm curious if you sent it.
Nope, I did not.
Representative Zeller. Oh,
thank you, Mr. Chairman. I won't try to pronounce Mr. Halschel.
Halschel.
When you came up, you said Thomson Reuters. I've forgotten about the merger and the high-tech merger. Since you've been through one of these merger acquisition type things, how was that beneficial to, you know, Minnesota or wherever you were coming from or going to?
Mr. Halschel.
Thank you. We've been through a couple mergers. Back in 1995, Thomson bought West Publishing to create what, you know, became Thomson West. And there were a lot of doomsayers at that point, worried about what it was going to do to a local company with Thomson coming in. But we partnered with Thomson and really looked at this. And in the end, we're still producing over 52 million law books out of Eagan, Minnesota. We're generating over $2 billion online with Westlaw, our search engine technology, and that's all headquartered in Minnesota here. And since the merger with Thomson in 1995, we've created more than 3,000 jobs, high-paying jobs, in Minnesota and have had tremendous growth. Now, the next chapter completed a couple weeks ago where Thomson, with it, during our growth, acquired Reuters. You know, the news agency. And so it's another thing. It's part of our expansion. And we continue to use Minnesota as the headquarters for the largest entity within Thomson Reuters. And we'll continue to grow and focus our legal information business out of here as an information provider.
Chair Atkins, did you have a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In short, he's the carrot. I'm the stick. There's a possible... there's a possible good outcome if our friends at, I guess we should start calling them Delta, if that's the course that they choose to go down. They can do it in a good neighbor fashion. They can honor their agreement, and I expect them to do that. And in the event that they don't, we have the remedies available to us that we need to have.
Representative Zellers.
Oh, thank you, Chair. Just a question to the author of the bill, Mr. Chairman, on the 211 of your bill, and because Republic came up and some of the other airlines, does this affect any of those because it says entered into before, on, or after that date? So we're not going to go back really, really knowing, again, Mr. Chairman, as an attorney and one that is very successful, some of these agreements before, we're not going to go back in time the beginning of the Wright brothers out there on the Hill, are we?
Mr. Chair, Representative Zellers, I wore my tie with all of the defunct airlines on here. Just in, I don't know if they've merged with about half of these or not, but my wife won't let me wear this tie. She left town, so today I'm able to wear it. But no, Representative Zellers, that was not the aim of my bill. I appreciate you pointing that out, perhaps we can clarify that before we get to the next committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Dominguez, I think we're there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I want to bring this back to you, the employees, and what it means to the employees. You testified, either one of you testified on what this could mean as far as employees. We're losing jobs, up to 1,000 jobs. What does this mean about their career? What's the backup for their career? Are they able to get some support in the technology area? What their retirement? All those categories that we have to look at. What does it mean for them?
Chair Atkins.
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I think Mr. Oshelt's got my back on this one, just in case I mess this up. But the reason I was so interested in inviting Mr. Oshelt as past president of the Minnesota High Tech Association is because thus far, Northwest has made the assurance that these are not frontline jobs. They're going to be the headquarters is in jeopardy. In the event that that's the case, my hope would be that many of the skills that are present at that headquarters would translate well to these sorts of jobs. That said, don't think I'm taking lightly those frontline jobs. We had a lot of folks that came and sat up here who have not yet had much in terms of assurance about the quality of their job, let alone their job, let alone their pension, let alone their rights. Under the current agreements. And all of those things fall within our ability under these contracts, the hub, the employment numbers, the headquarters, that we fully enforce that agreement. But my hope is that the sort of jobs, to the extent that there are jobs lost, would be the kind of thing that, as Mr. Oshel talked about, we ought to be a great possible IT headquarters for any organization, and Northwest happens to be one that's going through this right now.
Representative Zellers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Before we vote, Mr. Chairman, I honestly am a little more comfortable with your bill than the previous one, because it says he can seek, and this is no offense to Chair Paymar if he's left the room, but surrendering previous agreements or previous rents or whatever the concessions may be, I'm all for enforcing the deal. If we made a deal, we should stick with it. We should get paid back for what we did. But when we're going to go back in time and, in essence, you know, break the contract that we're accusing them of breaking the contract with, I think that's troubling. I want to see the state get the money that they have. I want to do all we can to keep jobs here. Unfortunately, if we're no better than those that we're accusing, I don't know how we're going to do that with good faith, so to speak. And Mr. Chairman, I just hope that when the tax bill comes out and the tax chair breaches some of those contracts that the state of Minnesota has with Job Z providers, that you will be as fervent and determined to make the state uphold those contracts and those jobs for greater Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Hauschild, for coming, and thank you for your company in Minnesota and your commitment. Chair Atkins, any final comments, sir?
No, sir. I would just renew my motion that House File 4207 be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Rules with a recommendation that it go from there to the Committee on Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs.
Chair Atkins has renewed his motion. Any questions to that? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Those opposed? You're on your way, sir.
Chair and members.
Chair Atkins, do you have any final roadmap
I can do them from here. I would just renew my request that our friends at Delta become more compliant, and they've got till the end of business today before we take further action. And with
thank you, Chair Atkins. Yeah, members, with that, we're adjourned. Representative Zellers.
I just wanted, Mr. Chairman and Chair Atkins, that all members of the committee, if we're going to start issuing subpoenas, that we will be, I like the stick approach or the carrot and the stick approach here. I think subpoenas are a nuclear option. And again, Mr. Chairman, as we have in the past, renew our strong opposition to that and encourage you to use all other means. I understand you're frustrated, but if we're going to send a message to job providers, I hope it's not with subpoenas, it's with encouragement to the committee and commitment.
And Mr. Chair, to that point, as you know, Representative Zellers, the committee cannot issue subpoenas without two-thirds support of the committee members. There would be no further action taken in that respect without bringing back the entire committee. The only thing that I would do is, in the event that Delta continues to, well, basically blow us off, that we'd instruct Mr. Penner to prepare those subpoenas for consideration. Generally, that's enough to get people's attention. So hopefully that'll do it. Thank you, members.
Thank you, members. With that, we're adjourned.